Okay, if everybody could gather into a chair, and we're going to go ahead and get started. This is the Measure Applications Partnership Dual Eligible Beneficiaries Work Group, and welcome back to Washington, D.C. Beautiful sunny day, unlike the other Washington that I left yesterday in the drizzle. So we're going to just go ahead first and do introductions in the room. If you remember, on the microphones, you must use the little speak button in order for us to be heard on the telephone, and we do expect a few people joining us by phone this morning. So I'll start and we'll go around clockwise. I'm Alice Lind.
Sarah Lash, NQFSF.
Adam Burrows, geriatrician, PACE medical director, representing the National PACE Association.
Laura Linnebach, representing LA Care Health Plan.
Tom James with Humana.
Jenny Chin Hansen with the American Geriatric Society.
Rhonda Robinson Beal, Optum.
I'm Sally Tyler with AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
Dan Tiblahan, Veterans Health Administration.
Leonardo Cuello, National Health Law Program.
Steve Council, geriatrician at Wishart Health Services. I'm representing the National Association of Public Hospitals.
Tricia Moore from the Center for Medicare Advocacy.
Good morning, Jim Dunford from the City of San Diego. I'm representing Emergency Medical Services.
And Diane Stollenwerk, staff at NQF. Connie Huang, NQF.
And Tom Vallick, NQF.
Okay, so good morning, everybody. And I think we have at least Susan Reinhart on the phone.
That's right, Susan Reinhart, AARP Public Policy Institute. Good morning.
Hi, thank you, Susan. And is either Gail or Pat on the phone yet? Okay, we're expecting a couple other folks to join us. We'll just go ahead and first let you know that you have a few additional things in your packet this morning that didn't make it to you in time for you to have looked at them in hard copy, perhaps. So we'll walk through and wave at you when the time comes to be able to use these materials. But you have a few sets of slides in your packet this morning that we'll call your attention to as we get to them. You have a copy of today's agenda. A handout that will be necessary to refer to when we talk about the gaps and measures, and this nice long printout copy of the measure details for the core set. So all those will be as needed. We'll make sure that you know which thing to be picking up when. And as you get around to that part of the agenda, if there's something that seems to be missing, just holler out and we'll make sure that you get them. And for those of you on the phone, Sarah sent the additional materials out this morning, so you should have those available to you as well. We will have during the day various opportunities for folks of the public to chime in as well, and we'll make sure and let you know when we come across those opportunities. And so we'll just launch in now to just talk about the objectives of today's meeting. So, lo and behold, we have come to the stage where we're actually able to finalize the core measure set. So, hooray for us. we want to make sure that all the other work that has gone on through the other work groups is aligned with our work, and also thinking about our work in the context of the big environmental picture. So we'll talk some about that today, and you have a number of guest speakers coming to help give you the context of our work. The third objective is to actually look at some of the measure modifications that we talked about as being necessary over the past in-person and phone meetings, to look at the measure gaps and prioritize those, and then also to delineate some potential future new measures that would help meet the needs of the dual eligible population. And those will be a very important input for the HHS folks in order to figure out where they should be focusing the attention of folks who help them with the development of new measures. And then Sarah's also going to walk you through the outline of the final report, and by the end of our 2 days together, we will have fleshed out some of the themes and recommendations for the final report to HHS. Here is our familiar, what did we call this? The
ping pong.
The ping pong diagram. Or the this is just our flow of information that you are familiar with now. We're almost at the end here. We're at our February 2012 meeting since we last got together. The public comment was made on our interim report, and the coordinating committee met in January. So we've had various opportunities to bounce our interim ideas off of the larger public. And today, as you see in the list of themes in our analytics strategy, we've gone through most of the work. We still need to flesh out a little bit more on the data source issues. We still need to delve into the measures currently in use and where those gaps are. But the focus area for today is that last box on refining the core measure set, identifying the gaps, and proposing modifications. So this is hence the nice long time together. So having more than a day will help. This is just for today's agenda, just so you're sort of oriented to what we're going to try to accomplish on day one. We have, as I said, some guest speakers to talk about the applications within and outside of HHS. We'll be getting right into the core measure set even before lunch this morning, and then be able to talk about how does that sync up with the adult core measure set. And this afternoon, we have, again, broader themes about how does our work relate to home and community-based services. But in addition, because the topic about stratification and how to make sure that the measures that we choose are usable in the various programs that dual eligibles participate in, we have a special theme area this afternoon on stratification and other ways to use these measure sets. Our vision is familiar to you by now, and I'll just pause at that slide for a minute so you remember what we're all here about. this is the action slide, okay. So here's our guiding principles slide, and there's three major topics here: the desired effects of the measures, the measurement design, and the use of data to support them. So under the desired effects, we obviously have the need to promote integrated care for duals, ensuring cultural competence and health equity. Under measurement design, we've talked a lot about this cascading levels of analysis and how the measures kind of fit together as a set, that the goals of care need to be aligned with which outcomes measures that we choose. We're trying to always keep parsimony in mind as we choose measures and look at gaps. And because of that, closely tied is the use of cross-cutting measures so that we don't just choose measures that only have one purpose. We also have inclusivity and avoiding undesirable consequences as a kind of backdrop to the way that we choose measures. And then finally, under the topics of data, how data sharing will support all of this work, the use of data in a dynamic system, and then making the best use of available data. And this has been kind of my life over the past couple of months, is helping Medicaid states get Medicare data so that they can do some of this important work that has to do with measuring the performance of the system. Again, these are our familiar themes. The high leverage opportunities for improvement through measurement include care coordination, quality of life, mental health and substance abuse, structural measures, and screening and assessment. We spent a lot of time on this the last time we were together, and it has been for me, a very useful way of also talking to other folks who haven't been part of our long discussion about where the opportunities and gaps are that are very specifically related to the work around dual eligibles. And so I hope you have also found it useful, but just want to pause here and say, again, thank you for the work over the past year, because it has really helped kind of inform the larger dialogue around quality of care for dual eligibles. And then Sarah is just going to be able to fill you in here a little bit about the HHS input on the interim report and where we're heading from here to the final report.
Thank you, Alice. We've actually used this slide with you all before in a prior meeting, but to just remind you how far we've already come and where HHS would like us to continue to push forward. So in the interim report, they showed strong support for the major themes and messages that this group had sent, and they requested more emphasis on data sources and potential solutions to known data problems in the final. They're also interested in ways to evaluate the connectedness of the health system for duals, or what proxies might be used to get at that issue. I think we'll be able to explore that in particular during our GAPS conversation later today and tomorrow's activity around generating ideas for new measure development. Again, where measures don't exist, and we've already noted there's many significant gaps, what, you know, proxies might be used in the short term to fill those gaps temporarily while measures are developed. There's a strong interest in the needs of subgroups of dual eligibles, particularly the mental health substance use population. I think this group would agree with that. HHS has also asked MAP to suggest short-term, medium-term, and long-term steps for measurement, so to make our recommendations as actionable as possible. And then finally, to restate that the work on gaps and our prioritization of gap areas will help to influence measure development contracts and where resources flow from HHS to measure developers. And again, we'll touch on that topic very strongly tomorrow. So many things here are the meat of this meeting, and then the subgroup is actually an area we hope future work might get to. So we'll be definitely talking about data, gaps, you know, proxy measures in the meantime, and then we'll sort of push off the subgroup concept and hope to revisit that in the future. So for the final report to HHS, a slightly more detailed version was included in your meeting materials, but these are all the major headings. We'll give background about the measure applications partnership to those that haven't been involved, obviously. The second would be to actually restate a large portion of the major themes from the interim report, because that does frame everything else that we've continued to work on. So a lot of the content Alice just reviewed with you would continue to be represented in the final deliverable. The third section would be to present the initial core set, the first iteration of the measures this group believes are appropriate to use with dual eligible beneficiaries. And as a complement to that, the most significant measure gaps, where we're not able to find measures that are appropriate in topic areas that are still very important. The next section would be strategies, again, to get back to that point about being actionable. How can we work on filling these measure gaps as quickly as possible? And those come in the form of modifications to existing measures, which mega developers could work on refining through NQF endorsement or just feature testing and expansion of measures. And then also measure schemas or potential new measures for de novo development rather than building on something that already exists. The next section would be to think about the measurement cascade, levels of analysis, and potential applications of the core set. Those go hand in hand. If you're CMS, you have certain applications you have in mind, and that leads to a certain level of analysis. If you're a state health plan, you get the idea. It all trickles down. And then to touch on the alignment across programs and the relationship of this work to other important activities, such as the Medicaid measurement, home and community-based services, other major quality improvement initiatives. So we wanted to run these by you, see if the areas of emphasis make sense from your perspective, if there are other issues you'd like to see represented or are wondering maybe how they fit into this organization scheme. We'd be interested in the group's feedback on the report outline.
So we have time now for questions and discussions, especially just to make sure that everybody's clear about what the task of the next day and three quarters is for us to be able to supply the background information and fill in the missing pieces that need to go in the final report. So following convention, if you could just turn your card up if you have a comment or a question. Yeah.
Good morning. Going back, I guess, to the two slides ago, the HHS input on interim report, I actually just had a question about the connectedness, interest in ways to evaluate connectedness of the system for duals. I'm not sure I understand what that means, but it seems like it might be relevant to our report.
Certainly. I think that idea is related to our concept of structural measures and understanding how the system is laid out for specific groups of beneficiaries, their ability to access, health navigators or to have fewer insurance cards or to have their benefits somehow working together. There's probably a lot of ways where it would be new area, certainly, for measures, but that's sort of the concept there, the connectedness.
Okay, so one of the things that we've identified that is sort of sitting out there with not much around it is that I think relates to this is that SNPs, dual SNPs, would offer some sort of assistance with people in coordinating their coverage.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like that's something like
that's
what you're talking about.
Exactly on point. And for those that aren't in those types of health plans, what other evaluation mechanisms could get at the same concept?
All right, Jenny.
First, I'd like to just corroborate the comment you made that the whole SNPs issue actually had come up at a MedPAC discussion about what happens to the beneficiary who happens to be dual, and the fact that up until maybe more recently, the Medicare side didn't have to have a state contract with the Medicaid side, and so therefore you can say we coordinate care by giving a referral, but the transportation system available was probably 10 miles away, and not really coordinated. So I think the SNP world is really eagerly looking for measures that will allow that kind of connectedness or coordination, but it very specifically. The topic I actually raised my card for is something I had a chance to just briefly mention to Allison, to Sarah, and it probably comes in between Roman numeral 3 and 4, which is the core measures, to later on the strategies to address the gap. So it's somewhere in between. The one thing when we look at special population or subgroups of them, I think about older people with the duals who are a very large group, who are over 80, that take 18, sometimes 20 medications. And I know that the measure that we'll be looking at is about reconciliation, probably as an interim area. but I just want to register that this is an area that I know maybe goes into the unmet needs. But when we go the direction of reconciliation, reconciling many medications that might not be appropriate doesn't achieve a quality measure other than, you know, seeing that there's matching. So the issue of multiple medications with older populations or anybody who takes 18 medications needs to be addressed, I think, with a kind of asterisk or somehow much more so, because I would hate for us to go right into the measurement of reconciling without understanding the validity issue. So that's the area that hopefully we can talk about a little bit more later. Thanks. Rhonda.
I just wanted to make sure that within the statement of connectedness of the system, does that also include, besides the fragmentation from a delivery, actual delivery system perspective, does it also include the funding streams? Because without that, I think we're going to, no matter what we do, we kind of get lost.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. Any other comments, questions about the task ahead? Okay. Thanks. Oh, wait.
Sorry, last minute there. I guess for me, the question that I have to outline makes total sense, and as we've been selecting measures, and actually when we started working with the actual measures, was extremely helpful to somebody who's new to this like me. I guess the piece that I would like to know how we communicate it to HHS and others who are using this set is sort of what we think the macro level areas that we need to address are. So for example, you know, there may be hundreds of measures around care transition, but very few around, you know, screening for depression, in which case, you know, I wouldn't want sort of us to be sort of encouraging a lot of use around measures for something because there just happen to be a lot, and not addressing the priorities. And so when we talk about picking the actual measures, what are the things that we're trying to accomplish? And when we got that laundry list of measures, you know, it forced me for the first time to start thinking, well, if we only had 10 measures, what are the major areas that we have to hit? You know, I mean, if we've got 10 swings at this piñata, where are we aiming? You know, we're not going to aim for a small leg. And so it forced me to say, well, so I just kind of jotted down as I was looking this, like, you know, I want one measure at least in care coordination. I want one at least in transitions. I want one at least in home and community-based services. One at, you know, actually three at least in specific screenings of the things that we've sort of learned are by far the most prevalent, depression, heart disease, and diabetes, and then one in the area of safety. And it seemed to me like, giving someone a list of, you know, here are 40 measures that we think are really good, and not sort of telling them, giving them something else that says, here are the things we're really worried about. I have trouble understanding how that happens. And I mean, I know we've talked about it, so I know it's in the record, but I just don't know how it gets translated. That's my comment.
That's very useful. Thank you. I think by the time we get around to tomorrow afternoon, we'll loop back to that thought and make sure that we haven't gone way too broad instead of making sure that we have the focus that we need. Thanks. Any last comments or questions? Oh, yep. Go ahead, Tom.
Thank you, Leonardo, because that's kind of a segue that made me starting from. This is really a journey that we're doing. We're coming up by having a series of points to create a pointless painting that hopefully becomes a descriptor of the whole set of care that people who are dual eligibles are receiving. We will have to go further in the future so that we don't have people teaching to the test and just hitting those measures and ignoring the rest. We're not at that point yet. I think that's, but it's having a fair distribution of those points right now that will at least start the picture. Thanks.
Okay. All right. We'll move on into the next section then. Did you? Oh, Cheryl, are you happy staying down there for? We'll drive your slides for you when we get to that part. Okay.
So, as you all know, this work has at least two primary audiences, our federal partners at HHS, and then states and community-level stakeholders. And we're going to be hearing from them sort of in turn this morning to talk about ways in which they're going or anticipating that they would use this work so that we can make sure that everything is totally in sync. So I'll be going through a bit of material about the pre-rulemaking process that the Measure Applications Partnership has just completed for the first time. And the authority for this role comes out of the Affordable Care Act. HHS contracts with NQF to convene multi-stakeholder groups such as this one to provide input on the selection of individual quality measures for a range of programs. So this has been the major focus of MAP in December and January. MAP considered, I think, 200 to 300 total measures, and I think it was for about 18 individual programs. Study-specific work groups met in a series of meetings, and they were informed by general recommendations from this group as well. After selecting specific measures or making a recommendation about the use of those measures, gaps were identified for development, testing, and endorsement. The groups all considered alignment of how those programs need to work better together, and then they considered harmonization issues as well. So as you know, HHS has identified duals as a priority consideration for all of MAP's works, and it's one of many populations that could benefit from a more person-centered approach to care and the quality measurement of that care. As you know, they're served in every part of the health system, but they don't have their own measurement program. And so in order to expand the use of measures that are relevant to this population across the health system, they sort of had to be injected into existing programs across different types of settings. And so MAP as a whole considered the types of measures that would make those sets more responsive to the needs of duals, working from the draft core measure set that this group generated earlier. This sort of recaps the activities in process throughout the winter. I don't think there's too much more to add here. But in January, the coordinating committee approved the workgroup input and weighed in on a number of strategic questions. And after receiving public comment on a report draft, NQF submitted their input to HHS on February 1st. You all should have received a copy of that report from our staff, and I hope you've had a chance to look it over at least briefly. Again, there were more than 350 measures under consideration for nearly 20 programs, and MAP's input was sort of categorized into full support the direction of a measure, or do not support the measure. And there were many reasons that these categories were arrived at, but it helped to really put a fine point on where MAP thought the measures should go. Other critical takeaways from this report were that MAP adopted a person-centered approach to measure selection and encouraged broader use of patient-reported measures, particularly the clinician group CAPS survey of patient experience. Many high-priority measurement gaps were identified, and I think this group helped to push a lot of those gaps to the forefront. Patient experience, functional status, shared decision-making, care coordination, cost, appropriateness, and mental health all came up again and again as measure gap areas.
measures used in federal programs should promote team-based care and shared accountability through population-level measurement, as exemplified by the measure set considered for the Medicare Shared Savings Program, also known as the ACO model. There was a general observation that measure sets lacked measures of cost, and MAP recognized a need to establish feedback loops with HHS and the private sector regarding the experience of using these measures in the field and the impacts that they're having, so that there's really a continuous learning process for free rulemaking input going forward. So this group, if you want to see your fingerprints on the pre-rulemaking report, here they are. It was particularly noticeable in two areas. From the list of potential core measures that you had initially generated, in all cases where one of those measures was under consideration for use in a federal program, the MAP supported that measure. And other more general recommendations were around taking a cross-cutting approach to measurement, emphasizing outcome and composite measures, exploring stratification to reveal disparities and opportunities to improve those disparities, pushing forward in care coordination and shared accountability measures while not losing the individual patient's goals in the process, and increasing emphasis on behavioral health measurement and coordination throughout the system. So we would say that the influence of this group was indirect, in the sense that there's not a specific measurement program about duals at this time, but it was very powerful. We saw a lot of alignment, particularly with the long-term care topics, and to some extent the clinician and hospital programs. There was a lot of information gleaned from work groups discussions about individual measures that actually informs what we're about to do this morning in terms of refining the core set, so that we could get that implementation experience that was starting to filter in to the discussions. And it gives us a lot to go on in terms of improving our recommendations as well. And a lot was learned in the first year, and this group can be even more directive about pushing the voice of the dual eligible forward in these other individual measurement programs. So we've invited our partners at CMS to tell you firsthand a little bit more about how this work is going to be used. So if you would please welcome Cheryl and Jordan from OCSQ.
So you all are very lucky in that Jordan is going to do the bulk of the presentation, and I'll provide additional comments afterwards. And Jordan is wonderful and fabulous, and we're so excited I was able to convince him to come here, which was not difficult given the group and what the group is doing. So, go ahead, Jordan.
Well, thank you, Cheryl, and I apologize if I now don't live up to that very high set of expectations that you've set. But just a comment first on my enthusiasm for being able to speak with all of you. The reason in particular why I think this is an exciting group to speak with is that the conception of thinking about duals on a population patient-centered way, I think, very much resonates with what we're trying to do much more broadly at CMS. It's not going to be any surprise to anyone that at CMS often it's difficult to think outside of our payment systems, because that's the way that we're organized, that's the way that our legislative mandate is structured, and that's the way that we pay for services. And I think that certainly what we're trying to do is cut through that with quality measurement, so that we're much more patient-focused, so that we're focused on alignment behind a common set of goals. And I think the reason that that's important is that if we're all working towards the same things, that's what creates shared accountability. And so hopefully what I'll talk about a little bit today is how some of that thinking is evolving at CMS right now, and tee up some areas where all of you can hopefully push that thinking forward is really the group that I think is best established right now to be thinking about beneficiaries from a patient and population-centered approach.
blind?
Oh, yes. Oh, well, okay. Here's blind. I'm sorry. No, that's okay. Always have a backup. So, in terms of what I want to talk about today, there's a couple of things. So, first is what we've done is, for the first time at CMS, we have a national quality strategy that was first released back in March of 2011. And what this does is it creates a framework around which we can all be working towards a common set of goals. And I actually think that that strategy was particularly aspirational in that we pushed ourselves beyond just thinking about healthcare and measuring clinical processes and how well does provider X or Dr. Y do at giving aspirin to patients before they're discharged with a heart attack, and thought actually about a three-part aim of improving healthcare, health, and also reducing costs. And we have those three aims on the first slide here. And recognizing that while all of those are great high-level vision for where we're headed, it's kind of difficult to operationalize better health. So we drilled down a little bit further and established a set of six priorities that will allow us, I think, to be able to focus not only our quality measurement, but also the system's quality improvement objectives over the coming years. Next slide, please. Oh, great. Perfect. Thank you. So here is just a high-level view of the programs that CMS has right now that are focused on quality measurement and quality improvement. And I think you can, as I said before, already take away something from what the yellow boxes are up at the top, which is still largely a provider setting based organization. And a couple of exciting exceptions to that are over on the right where we have the population-based programs, which you probably recognize. And then also we have the Medicare Shared Savings Program, which is the essentially ACO model in which we're creating a population and patient-centered way of measuring quality across a set of providers. Now, most of the programs over on the left are focused around creating transparency on a set of quality measures that we establish in part through the consultation of the MAP. Many of the measures in some programs, all of the measures are endorsed by the NQF. And really represent a consensus of where the community feels it's most important for us to be measuring quality. The other piece that I would call out here is that fourth column, the payment model reporting, which is really CMS's venture from the Affordable Care Act into paying for performance. And the reason why I think that this is so exciting and powerful is it creates an opportunity for CMS to link fee-for-service payments with performance and quality. And to the extent that even though we're siloed in the way that we pay for services, if we can align how we're paying for quality across individual physician providers, across acute care settings, across post-acute care settings, we're able to deliver a much more patient-centered model for quality improvement, and that's what we're hoping to be able to do. So what we've done is taken those six priorities and established a set of domains of quality measurement that basically takes our quality objectives and translates them into descriptors of numerators, if you will, to be able to improve quality. And as we look across these initially, part of what the MAP is doing is providing a gap analysis in terms of where we are able and are not able to effectively measure things. We've got a lot of effort in clinical quality of care. And historically, that's been the primary focus of measured development and, quite frankly, of quality measurement. And that's no surprise because it's the most provider-focused. I think over the course of the last few years, we've really made great strides in having an expanded approach to our person and caregiver-centered experiences through the CAP survey tools, as well as a number of other quality measurement tools for patient experience. The thing that I always find interesting is that of all of the measures we have, these are some of the ones that are best validated in terms of their link to actual clinical outcomes, often more so than some of the clinical measures we have. So I think that's an important takeaway for all of us. And yet, functional outcomes, if we look at that same concept behind patient and person-centered measurement, is certainly a gap that we're working towards. Across the other domains, I don't want to spend too much time going into them in detail so that I can have time for some questions at the end. But the idea here is that if we can find a set of measure concepts, something like readmissions within the domain of care coordination as an example, and we can say, under Section 3025, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, which says that we're going to adjust payment to acute care hospitals based on their readmissions for a set of conditions that the Secretary will determine. Well, that's great. But unless we can hold physicians accountable, unless we can hold skilled nursing facilities and long-term care centers accountable for that same measure, it's going to be very difficult to move the needle on quality. And so, as we think about new measures, and as we think about measure development and measure alignment, what we really need to think about is how can we take a core measure concept and, from a payment system perspective, apply that concept across settings of care so that we're really truly not able just to align measurement, but to align incentives for providers to create that shared accountability so that we're actually able to move the needle on quality as a health system. That last slide that I showed you, as I said, really identifies measure concepts from a numerator perspective. So how many hospital-acquired conditions are there? What is a measure of cost or efficiency? What is a patient experience measured by? One of the things that the MAP talked about, and they of course are far more articulate and than I am, clearly, based on that sentence, right? Trying to provide you guys with fodder. The MAP talks about cascading measures. And the way that we're thinking about it right now is very, very similarly, to say that you can take any one of these measure concepts and apply it to a different level of aggregation in the health system. And that is going to be the way also that we can continue to maintain that person and patient-centered perspective throughout all of our measurement. Because you can follow a patient through each of these levels of aggregation. And a great example is the community-based care transitions program, which is a pilot program that we have at CMS right now around readmissions. And what we're able to do is to say, we're going to take a person-centered and patient-centered approach to measuring readmissions. And we're going to be able to show a physician, as well as a hospital, as well as a community, what their readmission rates are. And what is a particular hospital's contribution to a readmission rate that for a community that it serves? And this is, I think, a compelling framework, both from the perspective is that that's the way that everyone else in the world is measured, but also that there are true quality improvement levers at each of these levels of aggregation. And if we exclude any one of them, we're going to be leaving on the table an opportunity to be able to improve quality in a system-based way. So as an example, at the individual physician level, clearly day-to-day clinical decision-making is an important consideration, and a physician having feedback on how his or her decisions are affecting the population of patients he or she serves is important. At a practice setting, implementing decision support tools, systems, EHRs, clinical rules, et cetera. All of those are going to be at a higher level of aggregation, and that's a different set of interventions from what you might have to improve quality at the physician level. And then certainly at the community level, I think this is a bit more aspirational in terms of where measurement is right now, but it can be as broad as helping community-based organizations to understand what their role is in improving quality. It can be helping hospitals to understand how do patients flow within their community and what kind of partnerships do they need to have with post-acute care settings so that they are able to more effectively manage the flow of their patients. Again, patient-centered approach to measurement. And one of the tensions here that I think is difficult to wrestle with, but that this group, again, given the patient-centered nature of what you're working towards, is that as you go farther and farther up this pyramid, the individual control that a provider has is less. There's no way around that. As a provider, it is more difficult to control what the readmission rate is for your HRR than it is for the patients that you see as a hospitalist. However, there are still opportunities for providers and their institutions to be able to affect quality at all of these levels. And so I think part of the dialogue that we need to start as a payer community, but also as a health system, is how do we start to create more of that shared accountability so that it's not a I have control, therefore I'm responsible, and more a this patient needs to have the best care possible. How do we create the appropriate structure and incentives to make that happen in our system? Just briefly to reflect on, there was some discussion earlier when I came in about the 10 measure versus 50 measure question. And I think right now we have two different types of programs at CMS. One is focused on creating transparency and quality reporting. The other is linking those programs and the performance on those measures to value. And we need to approach those in different ways. If I'm the CEO of a hospital, I need to understand what's my performance on the five most important measures. But then if I am the COO and the head of quality improvement for that facility, I'm going to need a lot more granularity underneath that to understand what are the levers that I have to improve. And so right now, I think there's gaps on both sides of that spectrum. And what we're trying to do in terms of our programs is make sure that we're getting those high-level measures that really capture the concept of value within the system and quality within the system, but also then be able to create transparency around what are the underlying drivers for those high-level measures so that we can actually facilitate quality improvement. Value-based purchasing, I've mentioned a few times in the past, but really, payers are of mixed reputation in the quality community. But certainly as a public payer, I think CMS has a unique opportunity to be able to use that role to move the health system in the direction of improved health as well as higher quality healthcare for both the patients and the beneficiaries, but also more broadly for the communities that the providers serve. So I'll turn it over. There was a lot of high level information, but would be happy to answer questions or have any kind of discussion that would be helpful to this group and all of the important work that you're doing. Thanks so much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Cheryl, do you have any additional remarks?
Just a couple to highlight specifically. Thank you so much. That was a wonderful presentation, and it helps ground us into our discussion in the next few days. Just a little bit on how our work in this group fits in with the overall strategy and then Matt's other work, which may be helpful. So to address some of the questions, too, that I heard is coming in as I was coming in, the map is helping us through many of those ways as we talk internally as well. We have sort of the focusing on what's important. What's accurate, what's important, what do we know that works that actually measures what we're looking to measure with the MAPS recommendations of including within a core measure set, or this is a good idea, but it needs something a little bit different, or you know what, these shouldn't be used for whatever reason. And that helps us. We don't just, for the dual eligibles, looking at that and helping us focus as well on what's important, not just cutting and pasting or moving those over, but to say for this particular population. And the report from this group and the discussions that this group has had help feed into that as we think about it for dual eligibles. So you have the focusing of what is out there and available and existing that we could report, but let's get to what's really important and what's really measuring what we needed to report. And then there's looking at, which the MAP provided information on, and this group has talked about a lot, the gaps. And the gaps tied to what's important. What's important for this population, what truly shows quality for this population. So stepping back maybe out of our comfort zone a little bit, because let's face it, we have a lot of measures on clinical quality because we feel comfortable with that. It's easier to measure. But as you step back and look at some of the other areas, how do you, you know, what's really important? And as we've discovered, we were able to come to agreement on the types of things that were very important for quality and what needed to be measured. And then there were a lot of areas where there were just gaps. There wasn't anything to measure. So how do we very specifically focus on those areas? And making sure that what we're doing, again, with the MAP work, is aligned with everything else. It provides a great discussion, the quality strategy, the recommendations, a way to make sure that things are aligned. And the dual eligible population and this work group and the focus that CMS has really pushes that to the edge. It's sort of, it is, I think, the hardest group. And there will be a lot to follow, I think, based on this, because you have to look at Medicare. You have to look at Medicaid. There are two different programs. It's easy for, or 58 different programs, depending on how you look at it. It's easy to think that you're doing a great job aligning if you're really only focusing on Medicare, and it's really easy to just focus on Medicare. But if you keep bringing up the dual eligibles and you keep looking at what does this really mean for that population, it makes it better across CMS for our entire quality strategy, and it's really at the heart of it. And I think also it provides sort of that person-centeredness. It's the true focus on the person-centeredness. Because, again, it's easy in discussions about quality to think about measuring from the hospital perspective or measuring from the provider perspective. But bringing it back to this population truly helps with especially some of the key areas of care transitions and things like that. And finally, that concept of there are multiple layers of accountability, but they all feed to a higher level if you're looking at readmissions. And for the duals, you always have to keep in mind the state. So how do you think about different measures across settings, as Jordan said, and then different levels of accountability, and use all of that to move forward to improve care for that group? It's not easy, but the MAP and this work group and all of the work groups have provided tremendous input and are really helping drive that strategy and keeping us focused on what's really important. So.
Thanks, both of you. Very helpful discussion to get us going and to get our brains in the right spot. We'll start with Rhonda, Tom, and Rita.
I'm really excited by the direction in what you said, Jordan, so really appreciate that. You know, you brought in a concept I think this group has really been anchored on, and that is not only looking at Medicare and Medicaid-based services, but also community. So I kind of raised the question, because as I start thinking about this, that's a real complex thing to bring into the mix. And so I guess I'm trying to get you to talk a little bit more about what you think your strategy will be, because then it really, to me, gets on the state level, and is there an accountability on the state level to achieve certain measurement performance as it relates to their population? So I'm kind of asking, what's your strategy? Are you going to, because I know that CMS has some degree of, I won't say control, but influence, but doesn't have complete control over what states do. So are we thinking about using measures as a way and transparency as a way of driving states to think a little bit differently as to how they fund certain community services. And then the second part of my question is, given that a lot of the community services are 501c3s and are dependent upon contributions, how in the world are we going to reconcile that, or is there going to be a model for funding those types of services to make sure that they are there? So I didn't ask any easy questions, I know.
That's okay. I'll take the easy pieces first. Thank you. First, actually, let me just preface to say that I don't think we're at a point where we have a clear strategy yet. I think that we're at a point where we are very close to aligned on the vision. And part of what is going to be helpful from input from groups like the MAP is how we can move from that vision towards a more operational approach. I would be much more highly published than I am if I had the answer right now. Just a couple of thoughts. So the first is that there is some low-hanging fruit in terms of measurement. I think that a lot of the measures that right now are published by ARC and at the Dartmouth Atlas, again, they're payer-centered often. Some of them are more population-based, but we can aggregate them at the community level and look at what the performance is of a given community on those measures. I think the challenge with some of those measures is that we need to work from the top and then drive our way down, as opposed to the bottom and work our way up. Because it's difficult for us to say, from a quality improvement perspective, what is it that's driving the relatively higher cost of care in Miami-Dade County, other than fraud? And so we need to be working in both directions of that pyramid. The second thing is actually an area where I think that CMS is starting to make, and actually HHS more broadly is starting to make greater strides, which is how do we actually help this happen on the ground? I mentioned the community-based care transitions program. It's a good example of, I think, what we're trying to do there, which is to say these kinds of challenges in healthcare improvement are community-based and they're system-based. And so this program actually gives out grants to community-based organizations. And I actually don't know if having C3 status is a requirement for eligibility or not, but they're community-based organizations that are supposed to help patients through care transitions to be able to improve measures like readmissions. We also have on the ground quality improvement organizations, which are regional-based and locally-based organizations that help providers work through quality improvement challenges. And I think that as these programs evolve and create a broader sense of accountability across the health system, that those partners on the ground will be able to help providers think through how to make that happen more effectively. So I'm looking forward to input from all of you also on how to be able to push that thinking forward.
Thanks, Tom.
First, let me congratulate you. This is really a terrific presentation that you gave. It's clear that this is not your father's CMS anymore. Well, one of the slides that really made me start thinking was your one with the six priorities with the circles. Implicit in any kind of a schematic like that is that all of the priorities are of equal import and that they're all going in the same rotation. I don't know if you saw the article this week in the Archives of Internal Medicine looking at patient member person satisfaction with the healthcare system using four of the CAPS survey questions and then a fifth one that they've generated on 250,000 people. And finding that the correlation with the positive experience of care reduced emergency room visits but raised the global cost of care and more hospitalizations was a commentary that said, gee, they had such a good time. Why not go back again? That kind of study does have some methodologic flaws. But if it's repeated and becomes something which is proven, that's going to shake that, that's going to put some vibration into that whole paradigm that we've got there. And I'm not sure where your thoughts are about that.
Well, thank you for that question. Having read the abstract and not dug into the methodology, I won't comment on that. But now that you've mentioned it, I certainly will. I think that another thing that's implicit in the framework that we've proposed is a sense of balance. And one of the challenges with quality improvement is the question of, does higher quality care cost more or less? That is a fairly fundamental question that I know that our outgoing administrator, Don Berwick, had some strong and inspiring views on. And I know that there are an equal number of people within the healthcare community who have divergent views. And regardless of which answer ends up being correct, I'm sure that there's validity on both sides from my perspective. But we need to, as we think about measuring quality, make sure that we're balancing. And efficiency and cost reduction is also one of the dimensions in that framework. So to the extent that we identify interventions that are going to cost the system more from a utilization perspective, we need to be able to manage that by having a countervailing measure that incentivizes decreased cost. And this is not going to happen tomorrow. But as we've seen in industries that are quality-driven and that are able to race to the bottom of the cost curve and the top of the quality curve, it takes time, but that through learning and efficiency, we can find ways to be able to reduce cost and also to improve quality. So that's, I think, where we're hopefully headed as a health system.
Rita and then Adam.
I want to add in one piece before you came to speak that I wanted to add on, which is when Sarah was reviewing how well the dual group, I think, was listened to and had particular input that affected the other committees. I just wanted to share something that some of my colleagues listening and I felt, which was Alice did a tremendous job simplifying and yet being very direct in representing some of the positions here that were rather nuanced and rather voluminous, and yet you came across with some great, and I'm sure it was with the good help of all the NQF staff, mm-hmm. But I just thought that was important because I think we really did have some impact on some of the other groups' thinking. Now, to the figure at hand. I just wanted to kind of reflect on the whole issue of driving to the community, because so much of the performance measurement depends upon having numbers, and pretty large numbers, and it tends to, therefore, favor the large. You know, even when you're talking on physician groups, you're talking favor the large physician groups, and which is a whole issue that I think maybe that's where we should all go. But when you're starting to look, at least in more community-based care, that becomes more and more an issue. I remember I was involved in a piece of work we did. I'm from SAMHSA, a sister agency. And we did some work in Pennsylvania around their implementation of managed care because we were concerned about, you know, how it was going to affect those with behavioral health. And we developed a rapid cycle where we didn't wait a year out to look at the measures. You know, we would each quarter look at the measures of each county, knowing that, you know, it could be skewed because the numbers are small. But you start comparing, you know, that data, and you learn that sometimes the best response to data is to ask more questions. And the asking of questions in and of itself draws attention that sometimes fixes problems. But it's way before you could, say, tie payment to it. And outcome measures have much the same issue. You know, it may depend upon the acuity of the patient, and our ability to make those kind of adjustments are still not perfect yet, shall we say. So I was just wondering how you're thinking when you're looking at community is talking about rapid cycle kind of quality assurance as well as the longer term performance measures.
Thank you so much. I think that is absolutely the right question to be asking. And you framed the question from the perspective of how do we do this at the community level. For better or worse, I would assert that that's a challenge that we're facing at all of the levels where we're measuring quality right now. The way that we're approaching it with hospitals, and you know, I think that certainly the opportunity would exist to apply this principle to other settings of care as well, is to make sure that the communities that use the measures and that are being measured understand the measure. That is absolutely critical. If we, you know, put out a new measure that people don't understand and they don't understand how they can think about quality improvement in the context of their performance on that measure, then we haven't really helped to facilitate higher quality care. And so it really flies in the face of what we're trying to achieve. Now, what I would reflect is that I think that we need to help providers and help the health system think about certainly outcome-oriented measures in a slightly different way from what we do right now. There is certainly a contingency of providers who still view quality measurement as forcing cookbook medicine, as having to follow a set of processes and taking the art out of clinical care, etc. And what I would assert is that as we transition to outcomes and outcome measurement, even though it's more difficult and even though we don't know exactly if you do A, B, and C, then your outcomes are going to improve, this is where there's opportunity for innovation. And it is not, from my perspective, as opposed to CMS's, which I won't speak to right now, but I don't think it's necessarily the place to say every single provider in the country needs to do X. Because every provider's practice is different, every patient is different, and there are always going to be specific concerns relative to a patient and community and care setting that are going to lead to different approaches to patient care and to health. And as we move more and more towards measurement of outcomes, it creates the opportunity for providers to be innovative in how they think about quality. But at the same time, that comes with more responsibility. And it forces providers not to just teach to the test, but to actually build quality improvement into the way that they practice. And that's a challenge.
Adam and then Jim. No, Adam, Jenny, Jim.
I want to have a comment on a term that's been used a number of times, that patient-centered care, patient-centered experience. And I'm wondering if we can go back to one of your slides, Jordan. Are the slides still up? The one when you had the six domains and a diagram. I'll just wait till those come back on. Exactly. Thank you. So in down the left-hand corner, you know, so person and caregiver-centered experience and outcomes. And the measurement examples of that were, you know, CAPS and functional outcomes. And I hope that we're not making synonymous patient experience with healthcare providers, as it's reflected in a satisfaction survey like CAPS. What I think we've met here in this group, the dual population, with patient-centered care and patient experience. I think, you know, what we've always affirmed here in this group, that what we mean is, you know, care that addresses the goals and concerns of the patient, especially when we're caring for vulnerable, disabled, dependent populations. So I just hope that when CMS is thinking about patient-centered care and patient-centered outcomes that we're not just limiting that to the satisfaction with the care delivered by a doctor in an office.
Thank you so much for that comment. I completely agree. And patient-centered measurement is something that we need to do across all of these six dimensions. And yes, the patient-reported outcomes, functional outcomes, and how is my experience with this provider today is an important contributor to that. But certainly only one piece of how we would think about trying to capture that sense across the entire spectrum of quality measurement. So I appreciate that, and we'll certainly keep it in mind.
Jenny. Thank you. Also really appreciated the scope of the presentation, and also Cheryl's comment about trying to measure the right thing. And going back actually to that very same circle, I wondered if the frame, I'm going to talk about asking about the framing and opportunity for the research that goes into it, and secondarily as an example of kind of the potential momentary conundrum we're in. So the framing side, I wonder if there has been plans for studies of understanding what people's goals really are, which has been now built into this format, because the goals might be actually in a different domain. For example, it's not just getting a safe transition back home and doing well, but the goal might be is to stay in steady state at home, period. And that is actually probably a goal that I'd like to live my life, go to the senior center, attend birthdays and things like this, which mean functional capacity and participating in quality of life side. That's a different framing from the intersection with the healthcare provider provision system. I wonder if there have been studies to say, if you're a person who is a dual diagnosis person and a dual eligible, what's your wish? And that is to be able to not keep cycling back in and out. Unlike maybe this study in the archives that, boy, you get great hotel-like experience there, so maybe that's a good thing. But the majority of people probably don't want to do that. So are there studies in play to really think about what a frail older person has? I know a recent study that just I think I sent to Alice and Sarah about very disabled people, what do they look for? And what's a good life, under disability? So are there more in play for the different segments of the duals, thinking about what goals are you having at a point that you're economically vulnerable, which is really the dual designation. It isn't necessarily clinical, but when you get more complexity and when you get very, very disabled. So thinking about the various subgroups and dividing it that way. And I'll give you an example, as I said, 31 or 32 years ago when I was working in San Francisco at the program called Unlock, we had a 91-year-old woman who had experienced a hip fracture, and she stayed in the hospital for 3.5 days at that time. The going rate of quality was 7 days. But what we would be dinged on was the fact that we discharged the person in 3.5 days, but we already had PT, we had everything in the community side, which you're raising, ready to go, medications reconciled and appropriate. And so her recovery rate was so much faster, didn't have delirium, which now would be a measure. But basically, a very different experience. If we benchmarked at that particular time, which was done, we were skimping. But if we looked at it from an outcome base, it's different. So are we directionally able to start moving in that manner?
So thank you for that question, and also very much for the example. I'll use that if that's okay. And I think that's exactly the kind of story that we want to incentivize. That's what measurement should do. And I think to the extent that we can move measurement in that direction, that is absolutely what we want to achieve. I think that the impediments to that right now are the measures that we have. And we don't really have outcome measures certainly that we could apply at a national level or often even a state level that would allow us to get to that that level of outcome assessment. But I do think that we can get there. In terms of specific studies that would move us in that direction, I don't know of specific studies that are on the table right now, but I would say that we view that particular area of measurement as a significant gap and one that we want to be able to close for the dual eligibles, certainly for dual diagnosis patients as well, but also for other populations. And actually just reflecting, because I think that this concept of patient goal centered measurement as well, as both of you brought it up, and maybe even repositioning some of the language that we're using around this would be helpful. Because you know, there's certainly this concept of functional outcomes, which I think also almost makes what we're trying to achieve sound too clinical. And really what we're trying to get at is, what does the patient want out of healthcare, and is the health system able to deliver that in a high quality and low cost way? That's what we're all working towards.
Great. Jim and Steve and then Patricia, will let you have the last word, then we'll have to move on. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you. And I really appreciated that presentation as well. This week's Journal of the American Medical Association has an article about health literacy. It talks about this appalling rate of people not knowing anything. I think it's something around 12% of people are considered literate. And so underpinning all of these issues is the sort of the state of awareness of the consumer. It could be the provider that doesn't understand the tool. It could be the person that doesn't know what their options are. And I know the federal government has a number of initiatives to try to start to build health literacy, but are there metrics of health literacy that we need to have that basically at these various levels so we can simultaneously assess the receptivity of these entities to be able to accept what we're trying to show them are these right paths? Because to me, that's sort of key. I mean, I worked 2 nights ago in the emergency room. I took care of a bipolar woman who got a set of resources for battered women, and that was basically her resource set that she was going to be operating off of that night in a hotel downtown. And to me, it's that this person had very limited ability and clearly was going to need to be taught and reinforced what resources she was going to be needing probably for the rest of her life. So how do you sort of see the literacy component, and how do we assess and gauge where we're going in terms of getting a more informed consumer?
I think that's a critical question. I'm glad that you raised it. And you know, I think that to the extent that we're talking about patient-centered measurement, really an understanding of what's going on is almost an ingoing assumption on some level. I'm actually not aware of, I'm sure that there are programs within HHS, maybe Cheryl or Rita, you have some sense of what our ongoing health literacy efforts are. I know certainly a number of professional societies have focused on this in the past. But I think that one way that we might be able to help facilitate it as a large payer is by, again, pushing more towards outcomes. And it may be, and I think this is also going to be health system dependent, right, as to the extent to which this is a need. But as providers are able to identify health literacy as a driver for their outcomes, hopefully they will find ways to shift their interventions and shift their engagement with the community to be able to address that as a primary gap. And I think that to the extent that our outcomes and patient-oriented measurement can facilitate that, that would be a win.
Steve.
Great. Thanks. I applaud your overall vision as well. It's exciting to be a part of this process and hear what CMS is doing. I want to just address the gaps and wonder how the gaps will be addressed. Because in large part, a lot of our work I've felt at times has been reshuffling the deck rather than adding new cards. And as the discussion is centered around, you've got connectedness, community, patient-centered, all these sorts of things, integration of medical and social care that are not really addressed by current measures. So as we look to prioritizing the gaps and developing measures that really do better drive and incentivize people to work in a value-based, you know, model, improving outcomes, how will these gaps be addressed in a timely manner so that we do get new measures available that can help?
Thank you for that question. There's good news and bad news. So the good news, I think, is that the national quality strategy, and to the extent that these six domains of measurement that we talked about today become more broadly circulated and discussed, I think that they provide and help provide a common framework for being able to identify those gaps. So hopefully, going forward, different groups that think about measured development, CMS included, and ARC and other, and CDC and other, and SAMHSA and all of the other agencies within HHS that work on measured development included, will be able to be working towards a common set of gaps, or at least a common way of thinking about measure concepts that need to be addressed for inclusion in programs, CMS within the private sector and more broadly. The bad news, I know that Dr. Conway, who's the chief medical officer, has said this once or twice, is that we don't have a magic pot of measured development money. Mm-hmm. And measured development is expensive, as all of you know. And so I think that there are two takeaways from this. One is that we have to be very focused. And so we need to, as a community, identify really what are the true gaps. And I think that the map helped us do that to a certain extent by teeing up what are the highest priority gaps this year. I think the second piece is that we as a public payer need to be open to all of the other great thinking that's out in the community around measure development and be able to work in concert with all of the other measurement development efforts that are going on, so that we're working towards addressing the same set of gaps and can move these programs forward in a way that is, again, patient-centered, as opposed to this particular specialty needs a measure to talk about X. And not to downplay the importance of that, because those are also important measures for helping physicians, especially in subspecialties where there's a dearth of measures available of any type, but being able to think about how do we have that concept and that set of measures in conjunction with what is probably a more fundamental, more core and broader reaching and broader applicable set of measures that we all need to be thinking about as a healthcare system.
Okay, Patricia. Thank you. Sometimes this discussion is very discouraging to me because it seems like we've identified really good things and they're so far out in the future. And I'm very aware that CMS is about to authorize somewhere between 15 and 30 dual eligible integration projects to go forward in 2013, and we have no way really to measure quality for those. So I hear this whole discussion in that context. You talked about how we don't really quite have a way to measure what I think it was Adam brought up about the real patient-oriented goal. But I was seeing in looking at, I think this is the work maybe for this afternoon, we have suggestions for revised core measures, and there are three or four measures about home health care that focus on improvement. And those seem like a very concrete and obvious place to look for getting at this population, not exclusively this population, but the population of people with chronic conditions who aren't necessarily going to improve from receiving certain kinds of healthcare services. Their goals will be maintenance of function or slowing deterioration of function. And if we continue to have improvement as the measure, which it is now, obviously that will skew who providers are interested in caring to serve. But I think because there just seems to be such a wide gap, you talked about the lack of a lot of money to develop these, but there are some very concrete places where we can be moving toward a more patient goal-oriented outcome measure. So I'm guessing that we'll be actually, because it's yellow on the thing, which means we're going to talk about it. So I'm looking forward to that conversation, but just wanted to suggest that in this interim time period that may be very long, that there are places that we can focus in on.
Cheryl, did you have one final word?
Sure. Quickly on the health, on the question about health literacy and really more broadly the person's experience of health care. We are, a part of our statutory charge is improving person experience and how people experience care, have access to care, and understand their care. We've begun by doing a series of focus groups, and AARP also did some focus groups with us. They were complementary to each other, so that we can understand more how dual eligibles understand their care, how they access care, and what it means to them. We will be continuing that, but we've begun in that vein there, and we're beginning a series of analytic studies as well to see what we can understand about the patient experience. So certainly we're working closely with our Office of Communications that does some work on a beneficiary understanding as well, so that we can get a clearer picture of what the person experience is as a dual eligible and how do we improve that, not only in accessing care and understanding the Medicare and you, but also in their experience of receiving care. And that's started, but it's the beginning, and we are dedicated to it, moving to understand more about that and make sure that the interventions and the work that we test and the models respond to that and are informed by it. And then a lot of the state demonstrations, as they move forward, also are having stakeholder groups, focus groups, understanding the care and supporting the dual eligibles in those as well. And then, to believe me, all of the work that we have done and the map has done is informing the demonstrations and the quality measures that you will see in the demonstrations. While there are gaps that exist now, and as we move to an ideal, and I think it helps to keep our eyes on the ideal. I have a six-year-old who loves basketball. It doesn't hurt for him to think that he'll play in the NBA or potentially in the Olympics. I think what we're looking at is a bit more attainable, but it helps us focus, and it helps us make sure we're moving in the right direction. And we are taking steps. I study the map. I have pulled in Jordan and Karen and Anita and everybody, Marcia Davenport, everyone you've seen here, as we sit down and think about and what is truly important to measure in those demonstrations. What tools do we have now for the first year of demonstrations? How do we build upon those as more information is available? So this work is informing that concurrently, even though we haven't wrapped up. Will it be perfect and will it be playing at the Olympic level? Probably not. But it's moving in the right direction and hopefully will get us all to the measurement Olympics or equivalent of the NBA. So.
Thank you so much, and thank you very much for coming and speaking with us. It was very good context setting for the rest of the meeting. Yeah. Foster, I understand that we have you on the phone.
Yes, ma'am. Myself and Pat Ruin.
So we know how quickly to talk. Are you with us until at least 11?
I can be here, 11, and we can go a little bit after if need be, but I think we're going to be pretty brief.
Okay. Thank you so much. Also, for the folks in the room, just you might have already noticed this, but there's not a formal break this morning. So, you know, if you need to jump up, jump up. We're going to continue moving ahead. This morning, the next session is going to take this kind of backdrop of the how our work will be used for the HHS work to the next couple of levels. And I think we've already started getting into that a little bit. Thanks to Cheryl for your adding that flavor of the demos and what's going to go on in the states. I've also been working with several states, California, Oregon, Washington, most closely, on some of the work that they're doing, both in the broad picture of health reform, but also specifically focused on how the health reform in those states will take our work into consideration with the dual eligibles. And so, again, just, you know, it will all help. You know, all this work will really support some of the work that's going on locally in states. So, Diane, I think you were going to just do a little bit of context setting before we turn to Foster.
Yes, actually very, very brief. My role at NQF is the Vice President of Community Alliances, which really focuses on measure use and implementation at the state and community level. And so it's I think of it as sort of the practical reality of how you actually do this stuff. So your conversation already this morning has touched on a number of the questions that arise, whether it is the health literacy issues and the gap of, you know, handing somebody a brochure and thinking that that's sufficient, to the transportation that's 10 miles away, to the Alice mentioning working with states about how to access Medicare data and make the Medicare data work with the Medicaid data. The discussion about the SNP alliances and the great work that they do in terms of coordination across a number of not only traditional healthcare settings but also home and community-based services, but the fact that there's a lot of people who are covered with Medicaid that is a fee-for-service that does not have that, the benefit of that coordinated perspective. So as you can see on the slide, there are a number of just different issues to consider as we look at how does this translate into the actual use and implementation, and what might work really well in one state might not work at all for another state because of the way the state is structured or the data is structured or the geography or the market structures or all of those things, quite a bit of variation. So the issues that were raised here on the slide are simply just some topics. Again, it's thinking about managed care versus fee-for-service, and one that they're very different environments. The whole structure of data collection and sharing, and again, not in just the traditional healthcare settings, ambulatory, hospital, long-term care, but also home and community-based services, and extending beyond that. In my personal perspective, I don't know that if we went around the room and asked for a definition of home and community-based services, whether we would all have the same definition of where does that circle stop, right? What's included, what isn't included, so that's why other is there. And then also the issues as we move forward, looking at shared accountability. You've got measures, of course, looking at ACOs and the variation in interpretation of what an ACO is. I've heard some very interesting interpretations as I've been out in different regions across the country. And then, of course, the patient-centered medical homes, the insurance exchanges, the information exchanges. I didn't even include on there the SNP alliances, the health plan work, the managed care. I mean, all of those different approaches have some level of shared accountability. So it's both the measurement, but then how do you bring those different shared accountability structures together when they exist in the same community? So anyway, my role here is simply just to throw those issues out for to pique the discussion, because there's quite a number of implementation issues that arise when you talk about improving the quality of care for people who are both on Medicare and Medicaid.
Thanks, Dan. So we need to switch to Foster's slide. Or Foster, did you guys send slides, or you're just going to speak?
We sent some this morning, but we can just speak, and you guys can distribute them afterwards, if that's okay.
All right. So just so everyone knows, Foster Gueston is the medical director for New York's Medicaid agency, and also a member of the MAP coordinating committee. And with him is Pat Ruin. Pat's also worked very closely on the duals demonstration and broader picture of performance of measurement and improvement with Foster. So thank you so much for being with us this morning, Foster. Go ahead.
Well, it's our pleasure, and I think that we'll help you make up some time this morning. You know, we have really sort of four major points from the state perspective to throw out there, and look forward to questions and conversation. You know, the first point is that we, as a state, are very early in looking at a full complement of Medicare and Medicaid data, having been about 2 weeks or so into actually having the information and the data. And Pat can talk a little bit about what we've seen so far and what some of the issues may be in terms of using that information and so on. I mean, one of the things that we know, even before getting the data, is that one of the issues around the duals is it's a highly heterogeneous group. We know that there's a higher prevalence of multimorbid conditions, more behavioral health in New York, more long-term care and home health and so on. But it's a real mix, and we'll talk a little bit about that. You know, the second is that, you know, as we think about measures and as soon as your group thinks about measures, you know, our goal is really to align both with the characteristics of the population, as always, but also to try to focus on those quality issues we either know historically or we would anticipate. And some of those issues related to quality will be the same, I think, for any other population, and some, I think, are unique and can talk a little bit about how we're thinking about that. Just to build on that, you know, one of the questions that we ask ourselves, and I think somebody might have mentioned this, is, or it may be contained in another presentation, is that a way to look at this is, could be another way, just another kind of stratification of existing measures. And we can talk a little bit about, I think, what some of the advantages are of doing that and what some of the issues are about doing that, because I think it's probably, not probably, it is more complicated than that. And then last, we have, you know, sort of as a ground issue, issues around what is the responsible entity or organization for measures. It's a lot clearer, in my mind, hospital measures or health plan measures when those entities are responsible for all the services and may be contained within a particular measure concept. It becomes a little bit more challenging as you think about sort of the variety of accountable entities, at least as it exists currently, for duals in New York State, and I suspect in other states as well. So I don't know, Pat, was there anything opening you want to say? So we're going to split back and forth between our comments, and you know, it's brief, so I think we'll just take questions and comments at the end. You know, the first thing that I guess hits us in the face is this issue about accountable entity or entities. So who is rightly, regardless of the measure, the organization that we charge with accountability for that particular measure? And in New York State, we have a pretty dizzy, you know, a complex array of entities or non-entities, I would submit, that have accountability. So in no particular order, we have duals that receive their Medicaid benefit through fee-for-service and have a Medicare fee-for-service benefit as well. A second category would be individuals who have Medicaid through fee-for-service but receive their Medicare services through a Medicare Advantage plan. Third would be we have Medicaid partial long-term care plans. So for those things that are Medicaid benefits or Medicaid wraparound, those plans have responsibility. And they may be coupled with Medicare fee-for-service. Fourth would be Medicaid partial long-term care, where the Medicare portion would be in a Medicare Advantage plan. We have PACE programs in New York, as many states do, and that encompasses some duals. We also have Medicaid Advantage Plus, coupled with Medicare Advantage plans that include long-term care services and has to be the same plan. It's probably, I would say, this is the most comprehensive arrangement of both insurance and care delivery, second, I think, to the PACE programs. And then last would be Medicaid Advantage coupled with Medicare Advantage, where there's no long-term care services. Those are Medicaid fee-for-service, but it has to be the same plan. So, I mean, I mentioned this array of entities or organizations, just to, I guess, raise an issue in terms of how and what entity and who's responsible or accountable for measures is going to be interesting and going to depend upon, you know, a lot of these factors, and that's something that we, along with others, are going to have to sort through in terms of thinking about, you know, the audience for measures and ultimately the most important aspect of measures, which is, you know, acting on them to make improvements. So let's go to the next.
So let me, this is Pat Rowan, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I'll tell you a little bit about the dual population in New York State. In 2010, there were approximately 750,000 dually eligible enrollees in the Medicaid program and Medicare program in New York, spending on the Medicaid side a little over about $18.5 billion on the Medicaid side alone. And Al alluded to the, we've been working with the and Foster mentioned we've been working with the Medicare data. We're about 2 to 3 weeks into it. And we actually do have some figures that we can share that we're spending on the Medicare side for the duals about $10.3 billion. But that number doesn't include anyone in Medicare Advantage, and it does not include Part D. So our rough numbers on this are somewhere, those numbers add up to about 28.5. We think the number is somewhere between 30, 31, and $33 billion, so a significant amount of money for this population. I think the other thing that, and this is a little background where we are, states like New York and across the country have really not, I'll say this, we haven't paid attention to the what we call the other side of the benefit, which is the Medicare side. So we have put into place some programs that are trying to control and look at, evaluate the quality of care for persons that are duals on the, for the Medicaid benefit, and not really looking on the Medicare side. So, for example, we do have, like Foster mentioned, a partial managed long-term care program. This is predominantly for long-term care needs in the community, but that program is now almost 50,000 people. So the benefit in that is really home care, personal care, with some nursing home care and some other wraparound benefits. The other piece on population is we're beginning to look at the data for the dual integration grant, similar to the way CMS is looking at it. And I think we've almost done this anyway, but they really look at the population into three different groups of people: enrollees that are in institutions, persons that are already in a nursing home, enrollees with long-term needs that are living in the community, and then a term they call community well, which is basically everyone else. The middle group, enrollees with long-term care living in the community, is the group that is in that partial program I mentioned previously, Foster mentioned. That program is due to be a mandatorily enrolled program as part of our Medicaid program beginning sometime. It was delayed. It was intended to be a 4-1 date, but significant amount of money, significant number of people with long-term care needs living in the community. In addition to the 750,000 people, some other information that I have handy, roughly a third of those are under 65, and roughly two-thirds are above 65. About 35-40% of the money is actually under 65, and 60% are over 65 on the Medicaid side. A significant amount of that money is the office or is persons with developmental disabilities for waiver services for persons under 65, and for over 65, obvious long-term care needs on the Medicaid side, both institutional and non-institutional. So, Foster, you want to take the next slide?
Right. So, I mean, it's clear, you know, we await, like other folks do, sort of the output of your work group in making recommendations for measures. And I know, it's been a very thoughtful process, and I know it's going to be helpful to us in guiding us going forward. Clearly, with some of the changes that are going on, Pat referenced in terms of how we're organizing care, there are going to be more questions and issues about making sure that the capitated arrangements or managed care arrangements, that that the quality is also monitored, given the increased focus not only on quality but also on cost and cost drivers. So as we have thought about measures, at least to date, you know, there are clearly measures that are appropriate across all the three populations that Pat mentioned, and these are the kinds of measures that I think fit neatly into, you know, at least an approach for us as a state to simply think about stratifying those measures to the degree that we have numbers to allow us to, in many cases it will, across existing HEDIS or measures that we use in New York, and those include measures of chronic care related to diabetes and asthma and hypertension and so on, conditions that we know are, just looking at our preliminary data, looking at Part D data, are highly prevalent in this population, as well as all the, you know, relevant measures of prevention, you know, flu shots and other things that we think are relevant regardless of, you know, aid category. The second category, you know, so those are, I think of sort of the generic measures in which we do stratification. There are others which I would say are more specific to enrollees with long-term care needs, although I think more accurately these are the kinds of measures that that are important for anyone that has multiple chronic conditions and falls into some vulnerable group and or receives care in multiple settings or in from multiple clinicians. And so those include things that I know that this group is focused on: care coordination, transitions of care, measures related to functional status, to cognitive status, and so on. And as a previous work group member, I think, mentioned, for some populations, the goal is not, you're not talking about cure, you're not talking about the most important function may not be related to hemoglobin A1C level, but it really, the goal may be maintaining function. The goal may even be preventing accelerated decline or trying to bend the trend of decline, and I would say that in functional status, and you know, that calls for a level of sophistication about measures that, you know, while we talked about those, we currently don't have those kinds of measures or ways of thinking about what the comparison group would be or what's an expected rate of decline or whether that's even the right measure. But certainly based on some of the populations that are within the category of dual eligibles, looking at trying to bend that trend may be really a major goal for the delivery system and may be an important component of a measure.
So I was going to give you a quick overview of a few things in our approach, what our approach has been over the last few years. The partial managed long-term care program, like I mentioned, has actually been in place for a while, and the enrollment has accelerated in the last 5 to 7 years. We do have a set of measures on that population. Again, this is the community, persons living in the community with long-term care needs. We have based a lot of this on data collection of a tool we created that is a variation of the OASIS tool. But from that, we can look at activities of daily living, functional status through that, including ambulation, bathing, transferring, dressing, toileting, and feeding. We are looking at incontinence, cognitive status, confusion, and anxiety. And we're looking at these rates at a point in time as well as how they change over time. Like Foster mentioned, to look at, in this case, functional status progression, has it gotten worse? Has it gotten worse compared to your peer plans? We do have this in a proposed report that will go out sometime this spring, which we can share with the group, including these measures and others. Other measures include oral medication management. How independent is the enrollee in taking the medication? Certainly other measures such as flu shots, fall prevention, those are all included. So we based a lot of this on the home care quality compare measures from CMS. We've added some of our own twist to that to fit our program. In addition, we do also do a member experience of care survey. That survey is not CAHPS right now. It's actually a combination of a homegrown survey to try to really look at the unique set of benefits in this program that that these plans provide. We have that available on our public website. If anyone's interested, we can share that as well.
So going forward, you know, again, in addition to being able to take a closer look at our own population, digging into the Medicare data really for the first time, you know, we have a whole host of other kinds of measures that we think are important. They include many of the ones that folks have mentioned already about, you know, the degree to which current caps or future surveys of patients and family members and so on look at patient-centered experience and the ability for folks to meet their own goals. But in addition, you know, we're also proposing looking at a whole, you know, set of what we would call reduction of preventable events. And those include PQI hospital admissions, potentially preventable readmissions, potentially preventable inpatient complications, preventable emergency room. And then for some populations, although I don't think we have really a measure, there's a standardized measure, maybe there's one out there that I'm not aware of, but, you know, an appropriate measure may be to look at, you know, reductions in rates of institutionalization in long-term care. That is, keeping people in the community may be, you know, one of the things that we start thinking about in terms of other kinds of measures. So, I mean, these are the things that, you know, we're thinking about at this point. It's still pretty early. As I mentioned, you know, we look forward to the output of the MAP and of this particular work group relative to this. We're still, I think, you know, have some basic questions about the data that at least have been clear to me. In another project that we have in which we're getting Medicare data, we are not able to get substance abuse data. I don't know whether the data that we have for the duals include substance abuse data or not. Clearly, given what we know about at least some parts of the population, that's going to be important information for us to be able to have and or use for measurement and so on. So, I mean, there are, I think, ahead some twists and turns about putting the data together and making use of it for measures, as well as sort of the accountability issues that I raised at the beginning of the presentation. I think that's the end of sort of our structured formal comments. I hope this was responsive to what you might have wanted to hear from a state's perspective related to measures of the duals. And, you know, we're happy to take comments and questions from the group. Thanks for giving us the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Foster and Pat. I know folks in the room will have questions too, but if you could just talk for a minute or two about the challenges that you've had just bringing the Medicare data into your system to do some of the first looks that you've already done. And, you know, what specific question that Jenny had brought up earlier today about use of multiple medications in the elderly being a major concern. How, you know, what's your hope to be able to get the prescription drug data also so you can start taking a look at that issue as well?
Okay, certainly. I can go through it. So New York was one of the first pilot states to work with CMS to get the Medicare data, and it's been a little bit of a learning curve for both us and CMS to get the data and actually transfer it to us in a meaningful way. And then there's a lot of systems side issues that I think CMS has made major progress on. They have a toolkit now to help states. I think some of the things we've worked out with them it's going to pave the way for other states to get the data and to be able to do this quicker than we did. But some of the things that the challenges continue to be, we actually do have Part D data. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear. We have Part D data, but one of the limitations is we don't have money on Part D. We have no idea how much it costs. So some of the ideas on that is to price it at the current Medicaid schedule to get at least a magnitude of how much that those scripts would cost for policy decisions and understanding the program. So the Part D we do have, but we don't have the dollar amount, and there is a complete blackout on Part C. Not only do we not have how much we spent on Part C, or how much was spent in New York State for the duals on Part C, we don't have the encounter data, which I believe started at the beginning of this year. So both of those are fairly. I think the Part C is one that's going to be a bigger issue in terms of us on the dual integration grant, for example, because we can come fairly close, at least in terms of magnitude, on the Part D data. We can price it at, you know, AWP minus some percent. We can come up with it. to come up with a rough estimate of what the pharmacy will cost. But and we're working with CMS also on the Part C piece of it. So what we've done so far is looked at Medicare data on its own. We are working right now to link Medicaid and Medicare data at the claim level. So that is a detail that is a significant amount of work for states to do or their contractors to do. The issue there is that this is a split, it's a benefit where a certain service could be paid. Most services are actually paid by Medicare as a primary with a secondary payment from Medicaid. So to really count events across both Medicaid and Medicare claims, we have to match up data at the claim level. So that we have not done in New York. We're really looking at them both independent. So I can actually tell you how much money we spend on the Medicaid side for inpatient. I can tell you how much money we spend on the Medicare side, but I can't tell you how many events we had because they have two different numbers and they're not lined up yet. Those are the big challenges. Certainly the use of multiple medication in the elderly, we can start looking at those type questions on the Part D data. The only limitation from a quality point of view, I think there is no limitation from a future rate setting and understanding the cost of the program. We have some challenges on that.
Okay, thanks. Adam, you have a question or comment?
I just want to address this issue of the accountable entity, which Diane introduced and Matt Foster spoke about as well. So I would hope that in the work of this map that we would be respectful of that issue, but not necessarily, you know, captive to it. We've, I think, affirmed in a number of different ways that things like integration and coordination and continuity and connectedness are important values. And so if we can choose measures or recommend measure development that actually measures those things, then hopefully we will move the system in that direction. And even if there may not be readily available accountable entities because care is fragmented, hopefully it will actually force different entities to coordinate and collaborate and communicate and actually develop shared accountability. So, you know, I know this issue has come up a number of times, and you know, I think we need to be aware of it, but not necessarily beholden to it.
Thanks. Other comments or questions for Foster and Pat, or just in the general discussion area of what would be helpful to states? Leonardo?
Hi, Foster and Patrick. That was super helpful to hear, obviously, for us here, because it's a totally different perspective. And I have a question which you're free to take a pass on if you don't want to answer it, but you know, New York is kind of a leader state in the world that we deal with, and you know, we don't necessarily always have the same level of intent and goodwill in other states. And so, what I'm wondering is if you have any advice to us about how we should be thinking about helping states prevent measures from being gamed. And you know, how you all think about that as you're watching what your health system does. And so one specific example that I'd also like to ask about is the one actually that you touched on and Trish mentioned earlier, which is how you make sure that the measures are used in a way which doesn't end up creating sort of adverse selection where people are avoiding precisely the people who are unlikely to, quote-unquote, improve. So if you want to address either of those two, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, it's a great question, and as you predict, a hard one. I never take a pass at a question. I just can't seem to, you know, resist the temptation, even though I probably should. But I mean, a couple of things come to mind. I mean, the issue which we didn't talk on about auditing of data is really a good one, and to me, it's, you know, it's so a part of everything that we do that I don't talk about it very much, but you know, this does raise the issue, given where the data comes from and all the challenges of the accountable entities, about whether auditing of the measures needs to happen in some different way or really just needs to be worked into some way of thinking about developing the measures. But I think that, you know, it's something that needs to be discussed every time there's sort of a measurement enterprise, which is to ensure that the information is actually complete and accurate and to the degree possible, you know, not gained. You know, a related, I think, issue to keeping folks honest is, you know, we're pretty big believers in sort of the sunlight of public reporting, you know, the CMS is as well. And so, you know, maybe not everything all at once, but at least a plan for information to be publicly available, I think, helps keep everybody honest and everybody's sort of feet to the fire and is useful as part of the public dialogue. Whether people use it to make specific healthcare decisions or not, you know, has been raised for years and years, but there's no question that at least for the folks that are being measured and policymakers, you know, it's useful if information is looked at. And then the last thing I would say about, you know, about adverse selection and so on, again, to the degree that there are measures that relate to outcomes around which member, patient, recipient, or enrollee characteristics matter, again, there, you know, there needs to be, you know, an honest attempt to try to risk adjust those measures where it's applicable. And understanding that, you know, it's never, that risk adjustment's never going to make everybody happy. There's no perfect risk adjustment, but I think that to the degree that it uses state-of-the-art thinking and is transparent and is iterative, I think that that helps to some degree. So, I don't know.
Thanks, Jimmy. No, just would add, many of the measures we do on managed long-term care are risk adjusted for that purpose, that the ability to improve functionality when you are at a high, when you have many, many issues are limited. So we do a lot of risk adjustment of those results. The other comment I would make would be, and the health side would be, you know, one of the problems, and again, I'm being completely honest, states are not, we're not paying attention to, let's call it the benefit on the other side of the firewall, meaning we, you know, New York, you know, from nursing, we have, if you look at national data, that the nursing home admissions to the hospital for PQIs is, you know, in the 45th ranking of the country. We're paying for nursing homes. Medicare's paying for hospitalization. We're not paying attention to it. So we can call that gaming or we can call it bad payment policy, but I think what the help that we could on the state side is to continue the dialogue with CMS about potential shared savings in those type of models, managed care across both the Medicare and Medicaid side, because what happens here is, you know, there's an incentive to move someone out of the nursing home into the hospital. We also have a bed hold policy in New York, so not only are someone gets sick, not only do you have to not take care of them, we're actually paying for the bed. So there, that's maybe unique to New York, but other states are struggling with this as well. So who pays for what, and if it's really a benefit on the Medicare side, how do we share that savings back to Medicaid, I think are things that New York and other states would be very interested in continuing to work with CMS on.
Patrick, was that semi-responsive?
That was Leonardo asking that question.
Oh, Leonardo, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but it was totally responsive. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Rhonda.
That helps. Yes. Okay. Sorry. This is Rhonda. Just one quick question. You mentioned that you're not able to get Medicare D data, and maybe everybody else in the world knows why, but I don't. Why is that the case?
So let's Part D data is the pharmacy data. We actually have the pharmacy data. We have the complete data up to, but not including how much money was spent on it. So we have all the pharmacy data for measuring quality. We can use it for that. We just can't use it. We don't have it today with how much it was spent. In fact, we're working with CMS on trying to break that barrier down so we can actually get access to that. Part C data would be plans, persons, enrollees in Medicare Advantage. So Medicare Advantage would be obviously managed care, and the Medicare did not collect encounter data until the beginning of this year. So the specific services underneath that capitation payment, we do not have that information at all. And then, in addition, we don't have how much was paid in capitation, although we're working with CMS to get that.
So to get the whole pie financially, we need capitation dollars spent for Medicare Advantage, as well as the Part D data, the pharmacy data, the cost for that.
So
does that clarify?
It does to some degree. So I'm going to ask maybe not a good question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there a reason why the financials or the cost data is not readily available?
Coach Carroll's going to weigh in there for you, Foster.
Yeah, I'll try, and Foster can help as well. So we can provide information on how much was spent in premiums or how much CMS paid the health plan or paid the PDP, the drug sponsor, but we don't have the information to share on how much, we've not been able to share at this point, how much was spent by the plan sponsor for that particular prescription for that person. That's considered proprietary information, at least at this point, that belongs sort of, it's protected information because it's that contractual relationship with the sponsor or the health plan for the individual. But we have information about how much CMS spent, but we haven't been able to share that next level of detail, which is how much the sponsor paid for a prescription, the financials at that level. And again, we're working on it, but this is where we are now. We've been able to release a lot of information, not everything we would like, and we continue to work and see if there are ways that we can share additional information.
So when you say sponsor, you're talking about the health plan itself or the PBM?
Yes.
Okay. Rita and then Sally.
I have hopefully one quick question and then another. One is you mentioned, and just as I was walking out, I picked the wrong time to try to go to the bathroom, that you had trouble getting the substance abuse information. I'm curious why. Is that related to confidentiality or other issues? The second question is, as I've worked with the states in the past, I've seen as states make good efforts to try to be inclusive and transparent, that they sometimes get people from the community who want a particular measure that isn't a recognized measure. That, you know, I want you to monitor this regardless of whether it's a recognized measure. And then they end up with a set of measures that are standardized, and then we can't compare them across states. So I wonder if you've had that problem, and if so, how you've dealt with that.
So let me try the first one. My comment was around getting substance abuse data from Medicare as part of the MAPCP or the Multi-Payer Advanced Primary Care Medical Home Project. And my understanding of why that's not included, it does have to do with federal law regarding confidentiality. My comment question about the data that we have on the duals is I wonder whether the same issue is there, and I just don't know. I don't think we haven't had a chance to look at the data enough, but Cheryl may know in advance whether it does or doesn't, but it relates to federal law and interpretation of that federal law. The second question about standardized measures, I would say that maybe Pat's had a different experience particularly with long-term care, but I think that perhaps after, you know, 15, 18 years of working on and using standardized measures, we have, you know, some relationships and infrastructure and history about the relevance and importance of being able to use standardized measures so that we understand what they are, what their frailties are, and they are frailties. But more than that, that we can actually do some benchmarking to other kinds of to other states or to national benchmarks were available, because I think, you know, the entire community understands the value of that, the challenges of having measures that have no comparator. So I think that, you know, to date, you know, I've not run up against, you know, a tremendous amount of advocacy around a specific measure. I think the concepts often that families and advocates and organizations want to measure are things that we similarly would want to measure,
But since we live and breathe the more practical side of it, you know, we try to engage them in that conversation about, you know, we understand why that's an important measure, but we really want to work together to sort of push the measure developers, which is not us for the most part, to create and test reliable measures in that regard, so that we can really trust, you know, the output of that measurement. But
the only other comments would be there's been internal advocates of some of the measures we've had that are New York State specific that have become national measures,
right,
such as lead screening, which we've done since 94, which NCQA adopted roughly 06, 07, and the BMI measure, which we were ahead of the game, which we've, again, went to the national measure. We collected something. You're, by the way, Foster's the biggest advocate for that.
In favor of standardization, unless it's something I think of. Is that what you're saying?
No. There wasn't one yet. And then we adopted the NCQA method.
Right.
So part of it is sometimes we're ahead of the curve, sometimes we're behind it, but
right,
most we're ahead.
Thank you. That's helpful. Sally, you get the last question. Oh, wait. We'll let Deb have one too, but go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Hi,
this
is Sally. And a question for, I guess, either Foster or Patrick, whomever. You had mentioned that you have two coordinated programs in terms of the payers. One would be the Medicaid Advantage Plus combined with Medicare Advantage, and the other is Medicaid Advantage combined with Medicare Advantage, the difference being that the one including Medicaid Advantage does include long-term care services, I believe. So my question is for a dual-eligible individual who starts out in the Medicaid Advantage, Medicare Advantage, but begins to need the long-term care service in a very subtle way, the way most of us are familiar with people who might begin to need a home and community-based service, just maybe a couple of areas of ADLs that they may need assistance with. How difficult is it to transition over to the other payer system, and does it ever create a barrier for people receiving services? Can you address that?
That's an excellent question, and part of the problem with our patchwork system right now, that someone could be in what we call Medicaid Advantage and develops a need for community-based services, which those plans don't cover. So certainly right now those enrollees would have to disenroll and enroll into either a MAP, which would be fully integrated program, or into one of those partial long-term care plans that I talked about. The goal in New York is actually to consolidate to have fully integrated plans with the dual integration grant by 1/1/14, and we'll work with both plans on all varieties of these health plans to be able to do that. So the partial plans, which are traditionally, many of those are small home care type operations to either work with a larger health plan to become integrated on the long-term care side with the acute side with a larger plan. But that's the plan going forward because of the patchwork, and there is some bumps in the roads jumping between the programs.
Right. I mean, I think the trade-off is between, as often, trying to promote coordination and continuity of services, both from the care and the insurance side, but at the same time providing choice to recipients and enrollees,
right,
and not, forcing into one particular kind of product. So that's, I think that tension or that conflict, I think, is going to be with us for a while as we try to move to more integrated delivery systems and more integrated insurance settings, so that those kinds of transitions, which are inevitable for many of the a portion of the population, don't create disruption.
And just quick follow up, you had mentioned your goal is by 2014 to have it fully integrated. What do you see as the major challenges to meeting that goal, to meeting full integration?
So the major challenges is we have two or three different managed care programs, depending on how you count them in New York. We have the main, what we call mainstream managed care, with 3.5 million people in it for Medicaid, for non-duals.
And then we have this partial managed long-term care program for persons with long-term care needs in the community with another 50,000 people. The mainstream program does not have, for the most part, long-term care services part of that benefit, and the opposite is for the partials do not have the acute care. In addition, the plan, why it's going to be even more complicated, most of behavioral health is carved out of managed care, and the goal is by 14 to begin integrating behavioral health as well. So if you think of it, acute behavioral health and long-term care services combined, 14 probably isn't even enough time, given it's less than 2 years away. But plans have heard the message and begin to step up networks and try to figure out how they're going to do this.
Thanks. Deb, but then was Susan or Gail, were you trying to ask a question on the phone too?
With Susan.
Okay, Susan, you'll be right after Deb.
Thank you.
Have you given any thought to submitting new measures, the experience measure that you developed, the instrument that was based upon the OASIS, to the NQF for endorsement? I mean, it's one of the areas that we've identified as having major gaps, and it sounds like you've developed an instrument and may have the science behind it to support an NQF application.
We haven't, and we can.
This is the endorsement for the OASIS.
Good encouragement.
Yeah.
Susan, go ahead.
Great. Thanks to Deb. That was one of my questions. But the second one is that we know, you mentioned, Cheryl, that ARP is doing a lot on focus groups with duals, and we continue this work. And the real need seems to be, and Alice, maybe you're feeling this need, is to work across the states on a lot of these measures. So I'm wondering, Foster and Patrick, if there is some forum for you to be sharing what you're doing, and perhaps there's other states that have measures that could go to NQF as well.
So, I mean, as probably many of you in the room know, there are multiple organizations and forums to share some information, including, you know, whatever ones the federal government may facilitate, but through the Center for Healthcare Strategies, through the National Academy for State Health Policy, ARC sponsors, those are two organizations that have, I think, as a core mission, being able to facilitate dialogue among states around, key healthcare challenges related to Medicaid and other programs relevant to states, but Medicaid in particular. There's a venue in which Medicaid medical directors are able to share information about the programs, the Medicaid Medical Director Learning Network, and so on. And there's probably, you know, like three that maybe Alice you can think of or somebody else can think of. So the answer is yes, I think that there are some existing. They're not specifically dedicated around duals or dual measures, but they are, the issue around duals, around quality, and around delivery system and insurance models has been, I think, a pretty hot topic among states for the past couple of years.
Right, but my question was really specific around measures.
I'm not aware of a specific venue created around just measures, so the answer to that would be no.
Thank you.
Yeah, Helen, go ahead.
Hi, Helen Burston. Hi, Foster. So, we could absolutely take any of these ideas as well on the CUVP for making sure at NQF. I mean, if there are things out there people are interested in, they've got some concepts they'd like us to take a look at, we're happy to take them in, look at them, see how they fit into projects upcoming. We are also going to be moving to, likely in the next 6 months or so, a two-stage endorsement process where we would bring in measure concepts first and then have fully specified tested measures to follow. So these kinds of discussions will be a whole lot easier if people can just submit concepts and we can have that rich discussion about measures before everybody gets fully wedded to their fully specified tested measure when harmonization becomes really, really difficult.
Okay, Jenny, very fast question.
The question is back to the risk adjusters, and especially is there, are there tools now to really look at this more robustly because of the, especially with the disparities, economic disparities component. I was talking to Bruce Siegel from the public hospital system, and there was great concern, again, about the disproportionate potential negative impact to the safety net providers when, as we move along with these measures.
Is that a question to us?
Yes, if you have any brilliant ideas about it, that would be to you.
Far from brilliant, but I think that the one thing I would keep in mind is that there are a couple of different ways to think about adjustment and dealing with the issue, the good issue that Bruce brings up and others bring up as well. One is sort of the inside the metric risk adjustment, and I would say that there are some. I think they're getting better. I think the next iteration, I think, of risk adjustment needs to take better consideration, functional status and psychosocial status, as well as clinical data and claims data and so on. I think that we're looking for that sort of the next model to do that. But the other way to address that issue relates to peer groups and what's the comparator for various kinds of delivery systems. And when you get down to, delivery system measurement, which I think is where Bruce was going, then, trying to figure out which are peer organizations that warrant a reasonable, comparison may be another way of really trying to appropriately address the concern that Bruce and others have raised about unintended consequences of measurement with respect to, adverse selection or increased challenge based on catchment area in some cases or based on mission.
Thanks. Thank you again very much, Foster and Pat. That was great and a very rich discussion. We are going to transition now, and Sarah is going to walk us through the how do we get from here to lunch. And just to reassure you that if this next activity spills over into lunch, I am a firm believer, and if we say we're eating at 12, we're going to eat at 12. That's how I was raised in the Midwest. And so not to worry about that we won't have a little pause in the next set of activities. We will. So.
Thanks, Alice. One thing I want us to keep in mind as we move through the next session is fit for purpose. And you've heard from HHS and the state perspective that we're looking at using these measures for more than one application, which makes the set or the array a little bit more diverse than it might be otherwise if it was fitting into a single program. So that's one of many things to keep in mind as we go through these. We have sort of a series of decision points about the measure set that we'll walk you through sort of question by question. And to assist in that discussion, you will probably want to pull out your colored legal size handout of measures. It's so rich that the information about each measure actually spills onto two pages. So, for example, if you look at the first measure on the first page, it's NQF number 4. You can see the name, the description, the numerator, and denominator on the first page. The page immediately behind it repeats the name and number, but then you can read about which high-leverage opportunities that measure maps to, the data source, the measure type, and other fields as well. If you notice, some of the boxes in the far left are sort of color-coded to help us quickly identify those that we're going to be bringing up for discussion. So green boxes are measures that are proposed for addition to this set. Red are those that staff would propose to potentially remove, and yellow are in the middle, it's a mix. So we'll have further discussion about many of these. So in November, you all examined a large pool of available measures and small groups, and all of those measures applied to our five high-leverage opportunity areas. After a post-meeting survey, that list was further narrowed to the 23 measures that we've been referring to as a draft core set up to this point. After further research into these measures on the part of staff and also through new information that came to light during the pre-rulemaking process, again, we'll be raising several issues for your consideration, and we hope to finalize sort of an initial iteration of a set of measures we can say are appropriate for use with dual-eligible beneficiaries. So just to characterize the draft set as we begin, 23 total measures, a mix of types, heavily processed, but also include patient experience and outcome. Largely an ambulatory care focused set, but with attention to hospital and long-term care settings as well. Many of them are at a facility or clinician level of analysis currently, with fewer at broader health plan or population levels. Data sources also vary. Many measures have more than one possible data source, but many of them come from claims or EHRs, and so that's just a little bit of background for you. Not to say that any of those characteristics are better or worse for the set, but we do recognize that we have a very mixed bag of technical specifications of these measures, and we'll probably be framing the set as such in the final report. So this slide lays out the topics of the measures in the five high leverage opportunity areas that the group has identified. This takes sometimes a long measure name or measure description and boils it down to a topic so that you can see it quickly. In quality of life, we have measures about mobility, palliative care, health-related quality of life, and functional status assessment on a high level. And I'll just give you a second to read the rest of the slide for yourself. We did draw out patient experience into an other category because it's important cross-cutting to all five of the topics. This is the first of our potential changes, and I'm going to move from the relatively simple to the more complex. And so we'll begin with the issue of related or paired measures. In the development process, these are developed as a set, and they need to be continued to be used together to satisfy the developer's intent. We had the HBIS 7 measure of a post-discharge continuing care plan transmitted to the next level of care provider. There is a measure that goes along with that about that plan actually being created. And we would propose that HBIS 6 also be added on the technicality almost that these are paired measures. And unless I hear an objection, I will just continue to move on. But yes, Deb.
Is the next, I guess I'm confused about people who leave the hospital and they go to the community and they're also receiving community-based long-term care support. Who is the next provider? Is it the primary care physician or is it the home and community-based services provider? And in reality, they both should have a plan of care.
I mean, we can look at the specification of the measure. It's on page... Oh, it's hospital to outpatient? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just to add to that, I think, you know, some of this is you're trying to fit some square pegs in some round holes, just to be perfectly honest. That measure was designed explicitly for the outpatient, the inpatient to the outpatient experience, with the expectation of going to the next provider being the next outpatient provider. So I think part of what I would hope is the measurement side of the house is that, in fact, there are obvious potential modifications we could ask the developers to make to be more expansive and responsive to this population. And secondly, I'm still, based on Foster's, you know, the previous presentation, it still feels to me like we're mixing all the different cohorts together here in a way that's a little confusing.
just because we know there are distinct populations, and I hope we could get to that at some point.
Sure, first Rhonda and then Trish.
Is there a reason why one would not think about pairing post-discharge follow-up measure, which is a HEDIS measure, let's say, for at least for behavioral health, which concretely requires that there is some contact with that post-discharge provider?
That is a separate measure, and the paired is a technical distinction. So the measure you're referring to comes out of a different set from a different developer. And I believe that was under consideration earlier, but didn't make it into the draft set. Are you proposing that we go back and examine that as a potential candidate for the set?
I think it should, because it allows for administrative data to be another way of perhaps getting at this continuing care piece. When you talk about a plan being transmitted, you're either talking about electronic medical records as a way of looking at this or some kind of audit process, which makes me feel that this may not be a measure that can have much volume behind it in some way. So maybe I'm getting into the weeds here, but...
This is the weedy part of the agenda.
Okay.
That's okay.
I just think adding that to this, even though it's a different developer, I think gives it more meat and certainly more touch points to look at to confirm that there was some type of continuing care or follow-up or transition.
Okay. So just to be absolutely sure we identify the right measure from the portfolio, it's a HEDIS measure. Okay. Helen's going to pull it up for us, and we can talk about it a little bit further. Trish.
The two measures that are here, 0558 and 0557, as they're written in our materials, are just for psychiatric hospital discharges, and that's a huge limitation, obviously, that we would want, want it expanded beyond psychiatric hospitals.
Okay, we can note that. We'll be talking more about potential modifications, and that is one that we'll note in that category. Tom.
This may be more of a question for Cheryl, but I'll throw it out in general. If our role is in the generation of useful measure sets for CMS for HHS anyway, as a primary goal. And Cheryl and Jordan presented a different construct in terms of the six priority areas. I would like to be able to see if on this set of draft characteristics, if we could at least say, are we going to have a good distribution among those six priorities?
I think it's okay if we don't have a good distribution, as long as we're focusing, especially because I think this group focuses more on what we're missing and what exists but isn't quite right. So I would actually hope that this group and think this group may have, especially for the future or longer term work, fewer on the clinical focus and more on the community, more on some of the others. So I think as long as we focus on what's important, we can fit it into this six-piece construct. I think all of the areas are important, some of which have just not gotten as much attention, and I would actually like to see this group spend more time on those and more thinking on those for us.
Okay, so just to be able to reach consensus about each one of these points individually, is the feeling in the room that we're okay adding HSIP 6, number 0557, to the set, and then we'll take up Rhonda's other additions separately. Any objection?
Sorry, I don't have an objection, but I did want to just have, a question of clarification. So in putting it in the set, I'm imagining that there would be something indicating to CMS that, or to us, that We think this is the right direction, but its limitation as it's currently written is not the ideal, and this is what we would, that would be the type of thing that you would include?
I think so. Okay. I'm envisioning a, you know, a table, a list of measures that includes a lot of information about each one, which NQS priority it's most related to, suggestions for modification and improvement, just that if we're going to include HBIP 7 or anyone else was to use that measure, they should know that it should be used along with HBIP 6. That's the issue we're trying to get at primarily, but it is all really rich discussion for how we want to frame the information for NAP and for the various audiences of the report.
Sarah, if I might add, just to call attention to the pre-rulemaking report that came out February 1. So HBID 6 and 7 were both measures under consideration for the new inpatient psychiatric hospital quality reporting program. And if you'll recall, the MAP actually suggested for, you know, supported for immediate inclusion those two measures, understanding that they were paired. So just wanted to give you a little bit of context of how MAP has actually looked, you know, overall, has looked at these measures specifically for that inpatient psychiatric program. But I think the point is well taken that we may want to look at this and provide feedback about how to expand it beyond, you know, that particular set.
It just it makes sense to combine those. I was just wondering if Rhonda was suggesting this alternative as a substitution for these two or in addition to these two. Okay.
The reason being is that as the HEDIS measure is written right now, it's restricted to behavioral health. I would love to see it redefined for general medical care, but right now it's restricted in this definition.
Leo, go ahead.
And the only thing that I kind of don't understand is how this impacts our, like, total number. You know, if you give me a choice between 20 standalones or 10 that are kind of double like this, then I'm going to pick the 20 standalones. So I'm probably never going to tell you not to measure something, being who I am, but if somebody's going to tell us that we're limited to a certain amount, then... I would just want to understand how this influences what the final result would be.
There's not a number in mind, a ceiling to the number of measures we would include. You made the suggestion earlier this morning about prioritization within our own list, and or to apply to specific subpopulations. This very important for our mental illness population, less so for. Frail elders and many others. So I think that prioritization is something that we'll get a sense of in the next day or so. Does that help?
Yeah, I'd just point out, Leo, in terms of your question, I think the MAP measure selection criteria could provide some guidance in that regard and potentially in others as well, although the measure selection criteria are meant more for program measure sets and not so much what we're doing here, which is identifying core measures that might be applied across various programs. But one of those criteria is about getting to the best measures in terms of not just going for quantity of measures, but going for the right measures for particular purposes. But since this core set is supposed to apply across many programs, over 20 federal programs that use measurement, perhaps the parsimony criterion plays a bit differently.
Excuse me, the next set that we're looking at basically deals with the non-psychiatric, is that right? That's a paired set, too, that we just failed to have the tools. So basically what doesn't get covered, the first one is primary psychiatric, but the other one is basically covering everybody else.
I think so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Before we leave the behavioral health measure, Helen, could you sort of read some of the basic measure descriptions to the item Rhonda had raised?
It follows after a hospitalization for mental illnesses, I assume the one Ron is referring to, which is a long-term NCQA HEDIS measure we've had endorsed for a long time. And it specifically looks at the percentage of members who have followed within 30 days of discharge for a mental health hospitalization. And I believe it is specific to a mental health provider. We can get you the details on it. But again, slightly different than the other one. It is not required to be an inpatient psych facility. It is not a separate freestanding psych facility.
Great news. That's already in the set. It's on page 11, 576. So we've already satisfied that issue. This has already been identified by everyone here as something that we should include. Okay, I'll move on then, in the interest of time, to the next suggested change. You'll find these measures on 13 and 14 and 15 and 16. The current measure is transition record with specified elements received by discharge patients. This group had identified that. There is a very similar related measure of that transition record also being transmitted to a follow-up provider. Number 648, the suggested addition has also been identified as part of the core for the Medicaid adult set that was published since our last meeting. And sort of on the general principle that transition records should be communicated to both providers and patients, we propose the addition of this measure as well, and we're open to comments and discussion on that. Tom?
One comment on this, and this is one that I've got an example from my own hometown, and that is that our transition of care form includes a place for patient/family goals of care. That's the thing out of here that would add to where we need to go.
As a modification? Any other comments about the addition of the transition record? Oh, Samantha.
Hi, sorry, just for the 0647, the potential modification to add the emergency room, I would support that.
Oh. Helen's reminding me that there's a separate measure that looks at discharges from the ER as opposed to discharges from inpatient. Would we want to include then those measures as well?
Could we maybe come up with an approach, like maybe the ideas, we kind of put the modification ideas on the table and then you help us project manage us through that, and then we sparse it down from there, since going back to that, we only get so many measures in our bucket. I don't want to lose people's good ideas, but then it will probably make sense to see what's on the table and see where we can then take things off the table because they're covered elsewhere.
Okay.
Or if, however people want to proceed, it would just be helpful to know whatever your strategy is.
So as Sarah pointed out, there is an exercise where you all are going to be suggesting modifications to current measures as well as new measure ideas to pursue for development. That's all tomorrow, right, Sarah?
Some of the modification and gaps is
later this morning. I was hoping it was tomorrow because that would give us a chance to then synthesize all the modification suggestions as a starting place for that. I don't know whether we would have time to do that, but maybe they'll be fresh enough in your minds that we could just carry forward with that into that exercise.
The downside is that you taught us, I'll speak for myself, you taught me about composite measures, so now I want to put everything together.
Okay, so we'll look into bringing more detail about the ER measure for the group's consideration as part of a whole set analysis when we're finished. The next change is about how the set asks the user to capture patient experience.
We had identified two versions of the CAPS as potential core. One was the clinician group survey, and the second was the health plan survey. There are surveys in many other settings of care as well, and we were interested in if the group was comfortable making a general recommendation that CAPS be used in every setting of care for which it's available, as opposed to the more focused recommendation that the clinician group CAPS and the health plan CAPS be used. I see nodding in the room. Any other comments about this subject? Go ahead, Doug.
I almost hesitate to make this comment, but there's a Medicare plan CAPS, and there's a Medicaid plan CAPS, and the reference period for them is different. Mm-hmm. And so you might want to raise that point.
That's a very good potential modification. Thank you. Go ahead, Trish.
Again, this may go to our whole set and how we prioritize and so on, but I was reminded by this of Adam's comment earlier, which I thought was so critical, that we not confuse my feeling like I had a good experience with my doctor in a particular setting from my feeling like my goals in life are being met by the health care I'm getting. So being cognizant of that, that my understanding is that CAPS is a little bit more on the first point, that we just want to keep that in mind as we're looking at our whole universe of value.
Okay, thanks for those comments. I'll move on then to a measure of family evaluation of hospice care. I think the group really gravitated towards this as, again, reflecting the patient and family's experience with an issue that's very prominent in this patient population. In reviewing the set as a whole, we observed that I would say 3, 4, maybe even 5 measures are patient-reported survey-type data. And there's a little bit more reporting burden associated with that type of information. And just to complement or provide another option for assessing palliative and end-of-life care, we suggest the addition of the measure of pain brought to a comfortable level within 48 hours of an initial hospice assessment. This measure is one of two measures in the Medicare Hospice Benefit Reporting Program right now, so it's already widely available. And so including this would be an alternative to the reliance on time-intensive patient-reported surveys. The family evaluation of hospice care is the pain brought to a comfortable level. The patient needs to tell the provider about their level of pain, but it goes in the chart, and that's where the measure is coming from, as opposed to a mailed survey after death and conclusion of hospice services, which is the current measure. An addition. Oh, I'm sorry. The current measure is at the bottom of pages 15 and 16. And, oh, I'm sorry, 3 and 4.
This would seem like a cross-cutting tool for the transition to care team, too. Are they also looking at this as a...
this is
acute care and transitions...
that would be a modification. Yeah. This is specified for hospice care only. Although pain has been an area that this group has discussed fairly extensively, there's different pain measures specified for nursing home use, home health use, et cetera.
And it's not the entire population of those served to the end-of-life provider. It's only those who had significant pain initially.
I'm sensing a little bit of hesitation in the room. Are there any further comments? It's okay to say no.
Well, I think the issue I'm sort of wrestling with is this issue of parsimony. I think, you know, we were instructed to be parsimonious, and so we wanted to choose those measures which got most directly to that which we cared about.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're adding additional measures for perhaps good reasons, but then we're violating the principle of parsimony.
Go ahead, Tom.
A concern that I've had as a physician who's been on a hospice team before, that's been raised by my nonprofit hospice, is that the incentives may be put in place for inappropriate recording of information. It's kind of like the kind of thing about, did you advise a patient not to smoke? It's the process measure that is too easily gained.
NQF's MAP long-term care work group met just last week and had a day-long discussion about hospice. Connie and Tom, are there other reflections about the use of this measure that came out of that meeting? This is already adopted for reporting, so I don't know that the group spent too much time on it.
Right. No, I would agree with that, Sarah. And, just to highlight that currently there are two finalized measures in that hospice reporting program. This is one of them. Certainly that group has spent a lot of time thinking about, assessment of pain and various aspects. So I think, it'll be interesting to hear more from this group, as you contemplate this measure in terms of the core for the dual.
And just one clarification, it is only for patients enrolled in hospice, so it certainly would not be applicable to the broad population. It's really, again, this is the issue with taking lots of measures that are, in fact, only applicable to subsets. They still sort of left, it'd be perfect for that subset of duals who are enrolled in hospice, but at least as currently written, it's not beyond that. It's really called comfortable dying is the name of the measure, so...
Right. And the one thing, Helen, thanks for bringing that up. One thing I will mention, actually, it did jog my memory in terms of the post-acute care, long-term care discussion, is wanting to broaden a lot of the measures that are, in terms of what are relevant to patients in that phase of palliative care into, hospice care. So there was a lot of discussion about thinking about measures and how it may be applicable not solely in just, a strict hospice facility, but hospice care, palliative care and hospice care obviously occur in a variety of settings. And so there was a lot of, emphasis on thinking of how to, bridge a lot of these settings with these types of measures.
Ted?
Are we just limited to Medicare hospice, or does it also include Medicaid hospice?
It's any hospice services, inpatient, outpatient, any of it. We don't make any reference to
okay.
Type of measures.
Thanks.
Jenny?
This is more the observation of dropping off. Yes, that's the self-limiting here. The question of as we move toward person-centric, and these are programmatically specific, just how we bridge this, because as was pointed out, it's not just Medicare. Oh, thank you. It's just not Medicare or Medicaid, which already is separate, but it's like somebody could not be in a hospice program and yet experience a great amount of pain. So if we're moving toward person-centric types of things, I just don't know how the technical kind of bridging occurs so that we get to the quality issue in addition to the funding program.
to me that's related to the issue of who's doing the measuring. Often it is the payer. In this case, it would be CMS, you know, measuring that particular benefit. But I certainly see that we would want it more broadly applied. Steve?
I'm just a little confused. Will this measure be used anyway in hospice, or, and how is it that...
It is currently used.
So that what impact will it have if we specifically bring it out in our measure set for only use in hospice? Or are you suggesting a broader use?
It would be to potentially slice out the duals from the general population in this type of care and to see if their score on this measure differed. It's one potential way. Samantha?
Hi, thanks. Forgive my ignorance if this was already addressed and I just missed it, but we're talking about the substance of the measures. Are there other aspects that we should be considering as well in terms of, it says that which ones are, I don't know which are e-specified, for example, or not, or if there are other aspects in addition to that that maybe we should consider in addition to the substance of the measure itself as we go through these.
I think at this time we're most interested in full-scale changes to the set, additions or deletions, and there will be a separate conversation about modifications, and then we can feel free to look at more features of the measures. Cheryl?
I'm going to talk a little bit about how I see this, and maybe it'll be helpful both with the concept of the numbers of measures and struggling over 23 versus 25, and also how this measure might fit into an overall report. And I'm going to go back to what Jordan talked about in the beginning as some of the setting and what we talked about. It's almost as if the measure concept is here, and this is a specific measure which would point out the measure concept, but as we know, there aren't other measures in other settings which get exactly to this. But so I would see the recommendation being, pain comfort, or even comfort in dying across, whatever it is that this group thinks is important in measuring, that's the measurement concept recommendation, followed by it should be in multiple settings, including the following settings. One measure that gets really close to what we would like to see is this measure. But it's only in that one setting, so please think about it broader. And then give us the problem of figuring out how to implement that. Not me personally, but somebody, Jordan, who left, will figure that out. He's very smart, as you saw. But in my head, I think that works better. And that way, it doesn't really matter, I think, to us, and we'll try to narrow it down at some point. But if you think of something like readmission, there could be five or six different measure levels that are appropriate, but I'm fine with counting sort of readmissions as a concept, but then figuring out how we need to measure it, you know, all cause likely, but then potentially other specific ones that are important for this particular population. So that might help some. I'm not sure if it makes it worse or if it actually helps with the concept of parsimony and how to use these, but that's how I would see this being particularly helpful in giving us guidance on how to move forward. A lot of the issues we're not going to figure out here, but if you give us guidance and the questions to ask and the problems to struggle with or the challenges to struggle with, then we can take that and move forward with it as we go forward after this report.
Thanks, Cheryl. That's very helpful. I'm going to flip backwards in the slides to show you this again, where we've talked about the topics of the measures and perhaps when we do our prioritization exercise within the set, we can do it at this level to emphasize concepts over specific individual measures. Seeing heads nodding. So we'll think about that and how to cue that up for everyone's consideration. Adam, go ahead.
Yeah. I wasn't in this work group, but I think actually the concept that was most appealing in measure 0208 was the family evaluation of care, whether it be hospice care or any other care. I think actually that may have been what was one of the appealing elements in this measure.
Leo?
Can I just ask if I understood from Steve's question? So if the measure already exists around, if 209 already gets used and reported a lot, right, and we only add in 208, we're adding a measure, but we're adding a measure that doesn't have potential for a lot of cross comparison to the broader population. In other words, let's just pretend that they were totally equal measures, but one of them already gets reported a whole lot for the general population, and one of them doesn't get reported a whole lot. If we pick the one that does get reported a whole lot, does that give us a richer data set for comparison to be able to evaluate how these services are playing out for duals, let's say?
I'm not sure that there's a yes or no answer to that. I think what this might end up being is a menu of options to states, CMS, and this would be too related to end-of-life care. They're very different. We've heard strengths and weaknesses. You know, one gets a family experience. One is going to be probably a little bit easier from a data perspective. So that's why they're both presented. If that helps.
Yeah, that helps. And I think my sort of just gut reaction to this when I saw it was just that, in addition to the fact that obviously we're talking about a real subpopulation, I think of the first one as being more broadly inclusive of different types of problems, and the second one being a very specific type of problem. So now you're talking specific population and a very specific problem. So if you're using 208, when there's bad pain management, presumably the family is going to be reporting on that through 208, so you'll capture some data around pain management, whereas all the other things that might go wrong in hospice care that don't relate to pain management would not be picked up in 209. So that's
a great point about the cross-cutting nature of some of these measures. I think I would propose that we maybe take a vote about the inclusion of the comfortable dying measure, since we've had such a rich discussion on both sides of opinion about whether it should be added or not. So if I could see a...
Before you take the vote, perhaps for clarifying, because it seems like there's been two discussions. One is whether the measure as it's currently specified would be added, or whether it's the measure concept of pain brought to a comfortable level, including but beyond the hospice setting, or including beyond the situation where somebody's clearly dying.
I think if the measure is added to the set, we would present it in a way that acknowledges the desire to broaden the setting as well as the concept of pain management more generally, if that reflects the worker's thinking.
Just the long-term, the all-day discussion that the other group had about this, what was their conclusion? I mean, because this is applicable, I mean, pain is pain regardless if you're dual eligible or not. So I just wonder if a more comprehensive approach already captures the dual eligibles' needs.
There's not a more cross-cutting pain measure. There are other pain measures for other settings, but there isn't anything that's global. And as we said earlier, this measure is already included, or at least the 209 measure is already included in Medicare reporting, so it was not a heavily discussed item at the hospice meeting. But what was is the desire to think about palliative and end-of-life issues more broadly beyond the benefit. Steve?
Oh, I just want to second what Adam's comment. Do we have any other measure in our core set so far that where the family evaluates the period of care? That's really what I think we were getting at, and looking at something, okay, to the concept we were getting at, that we'd like broadened beyond hospice care, as opposed to this being our choosing a specific hospice care, that hospice care should be different in duals, I think that's...
I know that CAPS can be reported by proxy, and just to say that into the microphone so people on the phone and the record, so the nursing home CAPS is often completed by family members. And so we had just talked about recommending CAPS in all settings, which would include the nursing home version. Rhonda?
So I think with taking what Steve has brought up, I think is real important, because I was kind of viewing the family evaluation of hospice care as a concept and not that goes specifically to a certain sector. But I think the concept is a good one, but then the dying, comfortable dying with pain is really drilling down even further. And I think as Leonardo pointed out, it may be the driver of the family's evaluation, which may be something that is done when one has a bad evaluation, that one is going to drill down to try and figure out why, may not be representative of that higher level of measurement that I think we talked about trying to get to from the beginning. That's how I was kind of thinking about it.
I would just add that my comment earlier wasn't meant to be sort of down on the measure. I like the measure, and my view would be yes, add it, but put it in the mix that we're going to prioritize, and it, you know, depending on how it's stated, it might get prioritized differently.
Adam, for now, we'll come back around.
Okay. So, is anyone strongly opposed to adding this measure for the time being to be followed by a prioritization exercise of the core? Deb?
I like the idea of also saying it should be expanded beyond, and so I would amend that.
Okay. Also that. Thank you. Okay.
All right.
No opposed? All right. Chair's prerogative. We'll have us take a quick lunch break. If you could all serve yourselves in the adjacent room and come back quickly, we'll get back to the agenda in maybe about 15-20 minutes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Sarah is going to launch right back in at this point, and now that we have the perspective of only needing to focus at the measure concept level, we hope to move through these next ones fairly quickly. Go, Sarah.
Thanks, Alice. So the next couple measures that I want to draw your attention to are on the bottom of pages 15 and 16 and on the top of pages 17 and 18. This is around the area of medication, either reconciliation, management, and or polypharmacy, depending on the way you slice it. And I think we probably do want to slice it in that way so that we can be more precise about the topics that we want to target. The measure that was in the draft set is a not-endorsed measure of drug-disease interactions in the elderly. We sort of surfaced through the pre-rulemaking process that there are sample size issues and the measure of failed endorsement on this, at least for this criterion. Therefore, we suggest removal from this edit. It has technical weaknesses, and we think that there are better measures to get at medication management issues. One that we would propose is 0097, medication reconciliation measure that is e-specified, used in value-based purchasing, and is being considered for the meaningful use program as well. This received a lot of support across MAP during pre-rulemaking, even including the post-acute long-term care work group wanted to see exploration for those settings as well. Jenny has already raised that polypharmacy as a distinct issue, and reconciling too many medications is not as helpful as it could be. So given our experience with the pain topic and wanting to recognize that, you know, more broadly, I think the proposal here is to remove the drug-disease interactions measure, add the medication reconciliation measure, but also try to identify polypharmacy and appropriate medication use as an additional area. And I see some heads nodding. Any other comments on this? If not, we can quickly move forward. We have a lot still left on the agenda from our prior session. Okay, good. Thank you. Yes, I should have tried this strategy earlier. We would, sort of summarize again, add the medication reconciliation measure and look for anything about polypharmacy or appropriate use of multiple medications. And try to find an example to tee up under that topic, but we would definitely call out that topic as a gap area.
To Cheryl's point, mm-hmm. since I keep trying to throw things her way, this may be one of those areas where we say there is a problem with appropriate prescribing.
Okay.
That is a topic area. Am I getting you right? And that underneath it, we may not have an exact measure yet, but we'd know it if we saw it.
And you think it's mostly related to the number of medications, or is it over prescribing?
As I understand it, the state of Mississippi in Medicaid has a limit of 5 prescriptions per person, and that they saw a reduction in drug-related events when they went to that.
Huh.
I don't know if that's the right number or not. But it's the concept of having to make appropriate decisions. And there's a really, you could generate processes to do that.
Very interesting. Deb?
I'd like to put in a plug for the use of administrative data. The numbers aren't too small to measure at the nursing home level. You know, you have prescription medications for everybody in the nursing home in the administrative data. And you've got Part D data. So it seems like there could be some, maybe we're talking about community-level measures as opposed to a provider measure or something to bring the issue to the forefront other than the Inspector General testifying at Congress.
Okay. Other support for that comment in the room. The next potential change is around the daily activity function as measured by the AMPAC tool. This is measure number 430, and you can find it on pages 17 and 18 in your handout. It came to light that this tool has floor effects and a reduced level of sensitivity when being used with complex patients. Certainly, we have a lot of complex patients in the dual eligible population, and we were not sure to the extent to which this MPEC tool is used in post-acute care settings, and again, it's only in the post-acute care setting. So that should cast enough doubt that we wanted to raise this as a potential removal. So option one would be to leave it in the set. Option two would be to remove it from the set. And because we have found functional status to be such an important issue in our discussions, look to the home health measures, which evaluate improvements in ADL status. For example, we have already identified the improvement in ambulation from the home health set as a good exemplar of what we're trying to go towards. So that would be option two. Option three would be to take this measure out as not sufficient for what we're trying to communicate, but potentially there isn't a good measure that exists, and we could talk about this as a primarily a gap area. Adam?
Only that, you know, ambulation locomotion is only one activity of daily living,
mm-hmm.
And it really has, I think, a role in assessment when someone is recuperating from say, an orthopedic procedure or something like that. So I think the intent was to choose a measure that spoke more broadly to function, ADL and perhaps even IADL function.
So to be more specific, the other home health measures that are available for potential inclusion, or at least to use as illustrations, would be improvement in surgical wounds, bathing, transferring in and out of bed, oral medications, and dyspnea, which I have trouble pronouncing, but I will say shortness of breath. Trish?
Most of these go to the issue that I raised earlier this morning. I think of all of them that are listed here, the one that makes the most sense to me as actually holding to an improvement standard is possibly surgical wounds. The others, it seems, all raise issues of what happens to the people who aren't going to improve, and how undesirable that makes them as patients, and B, how we're not getting anywhere near to measuring what their goals are. So if we're really looking to move towards measuring person-centered, measuring my goals for my life, anything that uses improvement in most kinds of functioning, I think, I mean, if my goal is to improve, then that's a correct measure, but if my goal is to keep from getting weaker or worse or whatever, then that's not a measure. So I think that comment is just applicable throughout our conversations.
I didn't say anything all morning. It must be the food or something. A few years back, I had a technical expert panel on home and community-based services, and we talked about measure gaps. And the number one thing that the whole room wanted was to be able to look at change in function. And so I just want to second and third the endorsement that the concept of measuring change, whether it's up or down, or the same, is an important concept.
I do believe NQF is starting an endorsement project related to functional status. Hoping to start?
No, actually, NQF we are launching a prequel to an endorsement project because there are so many methodologic issues in this area. So we're going to be doing some work this winter with a meeting in mid to late spring focused on what are the methodologic issues of using functional status measures for performance. One of the issues is, of course, they're useful tools for quality improvement, but how do you actually use them for accountability? This whole issue Adam raised earlier and others about, is it a delta? Is it improvement? Is it stability? There's all these kinds of issues. Is it condition-specific? Is it generic kinds of measures? Which subpopulations are best suited for that? We'll then begin a project specifically bringing in outcome measures of functional status early fall.
Thank you, Ellen.
And this is certainly one of those huge gap areas that we were referring to. I'd favor keeping it because there will be a proportion of people in post-acute care settings that should be expected to improve. It may be a smaller proportion than what, you know, than a lot of the other measures. So the threshold might be 40% instead of once you've risk adjusted and such. But again, to stress the importance of, if we don't use this, we have a substitute or something else that fills the gap quickly.
Deb, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that it's great that NQF is going to look at this because it's really a big issue. But I'd also add to that, the measures of functional status drive delivery of services and whether it gets reimbursed. And so, you know, it becomes a big policy issue also, because the way that states determine if you're eligible for services is typically your functioning and some other combination maybe. So,
Samantha? I was just trying to, is 0167 in this? What page?
That is
20, okay. I'm sorry, I'm just slow. When you give us the page numbers, it's really helpful.
19?
19. And, okay. For the 0430, I concur with a lot of the comments that were provided, and also would just add that it is the type of measure that speaks to support services that may or may not be available in a community and could help kind of get a sense of that. And we talked about community earlier today. So I like the measure when I think of the support services that our community health centers provide. I'm inclined to at least keep it on the table until we look at kind of the full array if people are comfortable with that approach.
Yes, Tom?
Just a question is there an exclusion? It's not listed there, but certainly it's risk adjusted, which would also help in mitigating the concerns about patient dumping.
Okay. I think I saw a lot of agreement in the room when we discussed leaving number 430 in the corset, but talking about also this is an important gap area with a lot of emphasis on Delta measures and the different implications. So I'll move on unless there are other comments. Great.